you tomorrow morning from 7. Meantime, stay safe.
Thank you, Nick. The time is approaching 10 o'clock. PMQ's at 12 today, of course, which I think we can probably all agree is likely to be eventful. And the reason why it is likely to be eventful, of course, is the continuing fallout from both the appointment of the paedophile's friend, Peter Mandelson, to the UK ambassadorship in Washington and the subsequent revelations that he sort of kind of failed the vetting. And that wasn't clarified yesterday by Ollie Robbins. But what was clarified, of course, is potentially even more damaging for the Prime Minister. What was clarified was that the poor man almost certainly should not have been sacked, which is why many voices, some of them quite surprising, are today calling for him to be reinstated. So, where does all this leave the Prime Minister?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global Newsroom at 10 o'clock, the Chancellor says her number one priority is to keep costs down after UK inflation rose in the year to March. The increase from 3 to 3.3% was driven by an increase in fuel prices because of the war in Iran. Conservative Katie Lamb has told LBC the spike isn't just down to the conflict, though.
Inflation is higher than projected every single month since the budget of 2024. The decisions that the government is making are pushing up the cost of living, and it is already incredibly high. As you've mentioned, fuel, of course, prices have risen, but this government is looking to put them up further with even more tax in the autumn.
Sir Keir Starmer is expected to come under more pressure over the appointment of Peter Mandelson at PMQs later. Yesterday, the UK's former top civil servant told MPs he was under constant pressure from Number 10 to hire him as US ambassador. President Trump has announced an extension to the US ceasefire with Iran. He says the move is to allow Tehran to come up with a unified proposal for peace. Mr. Trump has also said that the US blockade of Iranian ports will continue until there's a breakthrough. England's Children's Commissioner has raised concerns about continued police strip searches of young people. The numbers halved since 2020, but Dame Rachel D'Souza says too many are still unsafe and underreported. Dame Rachel has told LBC there are also disparities in how white and black people are treated.
There still is 8 times more likely to be strip searched if you're black. I'm talking about the very intimate strip search. Let me give you an example. 19-year-old boy told me the first time he was strip searched as a young kid for drugs, he was told to strip naked with 3 policemen looking at his most intimate parts and laughing. He said that ruined my relationship forever with the police.
The Home Office says it's introducing reforms to improve policing standards. And commuters in London are facing disruption as a 24-hour tube strike continues. Some underground lines have been suspended and others are reporting severe delays. Members of the RMT union are walking out for another 2 hours in a dispute over moving to a 4-day week. TfL says the changes are voluntary. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 79 points at 10,497. The pound buys $1.35 and a euro 15. LBC weather, dry and settled with sunny spells for most of the UK today. Some outbreaks of rain in the northeast and southwest, a high of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission. And it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 3 minutes after 10, and thank you for choosing James O'Brien on LBC today. I hope that I live up to your to the confidence that you are showing in me. And I mention that because I am poised, I think, to annoy pretty much everybody with the introduction to this programme. I've been thinking about footballification, which is a word I think I invented, but it's certainly not a concept I invented. It's just a slightly layered way of saying tribalism. The difference between tribalism and footballification is that in football there are only two teams. on the pitch, whereas tribalism can accommodate a myriad of tribes. And I was thinking about the Keir Starmer, Peter Mandelson vetting story, which is no longer the Keir Starmer, Peter Mandelson vetting story, is it? It's the Keir Starmer, Ollie Robbins sacking story. And I think, I'm fairly confident that the sacking of Ollie Robbins is now a bigger problem for the Prime Minister in the perceptions of, most importantly, many of his colleagues, never mind the public or voters or his enemies, but many of his colleagues, the sacking of Ollie Robbins is now looking more problematic than the supposed, alleged failure in vetting of Peter Mandelson. But I was thinking that that footballification doesn't work at the moment, does it? Because there aren't two teams. It's quite a moment for me, this. I've found footballification to be an incredibly helpful key with which to unlock almost all of the big political movements of the last few years. In fact, it's probably worth reminding ourselves, Brexit, right? Utterly binary. Entirely footballification. I mean, there was a little bit of dabbling around in the shallows at one point with, you know, left-wing leavers, the Lexit idea, or the we're not going to leave everything, we're only going to leave this or that, which the leavers said. But they were all a little bit deluded. It was either you want to stay in the European Union or you want to leave. I wonder whether that has coloured us all a little bit. Well, when I say us all, I quite often mean me. I wonder whether I've become a little bit too binary as a consequence of Brexit. Because I was thinking about this Keir Starmer story, and I was reflecting upon some of the my particular exposure to social media is incredibly limited now. My Facebook goes nowhere near politics. I haven't been on Twitter for years, and I'm kind of king of the centrist dads on Blue Sky. So my feed at the moment is dominated by Starmerists or Starmerites or people who cannot accept that Keir Starmer is really messing up an awful lot of things on an extraordinary scale. And it occurred to me that there are many tribes now in politics, but also in this story. It's not pro-Starmer or anti-Starmer, is it? Let me run through a few for you, okay, before we get to the question of where we are today, because goodness only knows. So I'll give you, if you like, the Corbynites, and I don't want to use any nasty words today to describe tribes, because as I've said to you on a few occasions, I don't like causing unintended offence. I'm a huge fan of intended offence, but not unintended. So you have your Corbynites, who are persuaded and have been persuaded for some time that Keir Starmer is close to the devil incarnate, that he is an entirely dishonest, untrustworthy, dissembling, demonic politician who has betrayed principles and people with gay abandon. So the Corbynites hold him in the lowest of regard, but would still be loosely, or not loosely, but would still be completely described as left-wing. And then you have what I will call today the Starmerites, and that is the people who, I don't know how representative they are of broader tribes, but they seem to be labouring under the delusion that Keir Starmer is doing well, even as his approval ratings and the Labour Party's poll position is close to catastrophic. These are the people who would argue that he's not a very naughty boy. He is, in fact, the Messiah. Those are the two poles on the left, right? The Corbynite, and these are loose, but I hope helpful generalizations. This is where if you don't like my characterizations, just give me a break, because I'm not trying to offend you or upset you. I'm just trying to find the right catch-all terms. I'm trying to find the right umbrellas. Have I told you about my new umbrella? Did I tell you? I got an umbrella on. No, anyway, I digress. I'm trying to find the right umbrellas under which to assemble quite disparate people. They may not agree with each other about everything, but they do agree that Starmer is a wrong'un. And they probably think that Corbyn was a man more sinned against than sinning. So we will call them the Corbynites. The Starmerites, not the Starm Troopers, because that seems to be a little bit unfair. But the Starmerites, who are, or maybe Starm Troopers is okay. I don't know, actually. It doesn't, at second glance, sound like a particularly pejorative term. But they are the people who seem to be similarly, in my humble opinion, similarly are detached from observable reality. The idea that, of course, he's going to be attacked by right-wing media, but this is not a story about being attacked by right-wing media. There's about six pages in The Guardian today examining the mess that he got himself into yesterday as a consequence of Oliver Robbins's testimony. So, listen, I've written books about how they create the ecosystem in this country which can allow a population to be persuaded to vote against its own interests. And while I'm always happy to learn from others, I don't think I'm minded to take any lectures on what right-wing media does to left-wing politicians. Ed Miliband's dead father was maligned by the Daily Mail. Jeremy Corbyn, as many people in Category 1 will be shouting at the radio at the moment, hardly got an easy ride. So the idea that Keir Starmer has been singled out for particular abuse by right-wing media is unfortunately not true. By dint of being Prime Minister, the abuse assumes a slightly different flavour. But if, for example, you're saying, why is everyone talking about this and not talking about the Sunday Times revelations regarding Richard Tice's tax affairs, you are missing a rather large point, and that one of them is a Prime Minister and one of them is a plum. So, and until the plum becomes Prime Minister, you cannot expect similar levels of scrutiny or attention to be paid to both of them. So, the Corbynites, the Starmerites, then you've got the people I'm going to describe. I haven't got a tribal name for them, apart from idiots. People who use phrases like LIBOR to describe Labour, or two-tier Keir, because they've been given these phrases. They can't really justify them. What do you mean two-tier? Oh, people get treated differently if they can... Do you have any proof of this? No proof whatsoever, but I'm 100% certain that it's right. My inbox is full of people who use the phrase two-tier Keir, 30p Lee might say in the House of Commons, and therefore it must be true. But ditto LIBOR. So these are your people who are... I don't know quite what the word is, close to radicalised in their hatred of everything, full stop, actually, except really, if we're honest, racism. So they are the most sharp blade, they are the most useful weapon for politicians dedicated to protecting wealth. You persuade people that the real problem is foreigners, and that anybody who doesn't dedicate their entire political platform to the demonization and the denigration of foreigners is the enemy. And that is how you can see words like lefty become simultaneously meaningless and abusive, as if it's some sort of catch-all term to describe people who aren't racist. So if you're using LIBOR or two-tier Keir, you're a racist. So that's the next tribe. They're the racists. So we've got the Corbynites. We've got the Starmerites. We've got the racists. Then you've got what I will describe as the male stroke telegraph contingent, who might flirt with racism or a kind of middle class racism, but they have been brainwashed in a slightly different way. They might be susceptible to the idea that foreigners are a problem, but they really worry about things like the redistribution of wealth, or they are unhappy, even though they haven't got much in many cases. They're convinced that there are scroungers round the corner. There's scroungers everywhere. People are inventing disabilities. People are claiming to have problems that they don't really have. Everywhere you go, they're trying to pick your pocket in order to fund this mythical, extraordinary lifestyle that they've never encountered or witnessed except in the comments section of their favourite newspaper website. So they are not the out-and-out racists, but they are also likely to use words like lefty or even liberal these days to describe a sort of unspecified enemy that is dedicated to the idea of doing them harm, even though the harms that they fear don't really exist. So you've got your Corbynites, who think he's the devil incarnate. You've got your Starmerites, who think he's the Messiah. You've got your racists, your two-tier racists, who don't really think at all, actually, but they are very, very angry with Keir Starmer because there's some brown people living next door. And then you've got your Daily Telegraph, Daily Mail right-wing, who are terrified of the redistribution of wealth, even though they're currently, almost certainly, not on the beneficial end of that redistribution. So, and that I don't think there's a male-female breakdown here particularly. The Corbynites, the Starmerites, the two-tier racists, and the Daily Mail, Daily Telegraph, bigots, let's say, to be kind. So, what do the Corbynites think of Keir Starmer, and has it changed at all over the last few days? Well, they think he's awful, and no, it hasn't. What do the Starmerites think of Keir Starmer, and has it changed at all over the last few days? They think he's brilliant at most, and a man more sinned against than sinning at least. And have their views changed at all over the last few days? No, if anything, they've hardened. What do the two-tier Keir racists think? Well, again, as I said, they don't actually think about anything, but their opinions regarding Keir Starmer won't have changed at all, and nor will their ability to justify them or explain them, because they can't. And then your Daily Telegraph, Daily Mail people, well, they can't. Can they be genuinely morally outraged, because they were all big Boris Johnson fans? So the idea that they are genuinely convinced that Keir Starmer has done something deeply questionable or egregiously wrong is palpably absurd. Of course, being palpably absurd doesn't stop people from doing it, but have they changed their opinion regarding Keir Starmer at all in the last few days? No, because as with the two-tier racists, their opinion isn't built on facts. It's built on very carefully cultivated feelings. That is how they could make excuses for. These clowns are still claiming that Boris Johnson lost his job over cake rather than over a succession of calumnies and catastrophes causing death in many cases and criminality. But they are so bent and so carefully groomed by members of my profession that they cling to these little life rafts of plausibility rather than face the deluge of nonsense and danger that they have unleashed and simultaneously been caught up in. So the Corbynites, the Starmerites, the two-tier racists, and the Daily Telegraph, Daily Mail bigots. Who's left? Seriously, who's left? I'm none of those things. Clearly. Are you with me? Here's where I am, right? I walked into my office yesterday, and it doubles up as my sort of man cave. And there's a large pile of clothes on the floor, which happens almost organically. I don't know how it happens, right? The thing I've never got my head around, despite having over half a century on this earth, is if you wear something, but it's not dirty, you're going to wear it again so it doesn't go in the laundry. Where do you put it? Do you hang it up again? Do you fold it again and put it back in the folded drawer or the folded shirt? So I'm looking at this pile of clothes it's on the sofa, actually. I'm not an absolute animal, not on the floor. And I actually found myself, at the age of 54, I found myself asking internally, what do grown-ups do? What do grown-ups do? And that is the question I could... What do you do when you've worn something but it's not ready to go in the laundry yet? It feels wrong to hang it up back with all the clean clothes. What if you forget that it's got one... What do grown-ups do? And I thought Keir Starmer was a grown-up. I thought he's the kind of guy I could ask. What do you do with your clothes when you've worn them once but they're not ready to go in the laundry yet? It's exactly the guy I could ask that, because he always looks quite... I like his casual look. He's got quite a good middle-aged centrist dad football fan thing going on. Well, I thought he was a grown-up, right? I honestly thought he was the guy who, I don't know, wouldn't have a drink when we were in the pub and he'd drive everybody else home. Maybe he is that guy. I think he's a good man. At base, but the problem with the base is that there's an awful lot of layers you need to go through to get to the base, right? And the layers are not grown-up layers. The sacking of Ollie Robbins speaks to something that has been bubbling away in the back of my brain for quite a long time now. And it speaks to... I've got various words beginning with P jostling for prominence in my mind at the moment. A petulance seems a little bit too strong. Peevishness? I don't know. Impatience? I know that doesn't begin with P, but you take my point. This he's not very good at it. And it's a personality issue. It's not a policy issue or even a political issue. It's a personality issue. Nothing's ever his fault. That he's too enthralled to the media that, you're quite right to remind me, attacks him unconscionably, but ignore them or tell them to sling their hooks. Don't bend to the campaigns that they love. If you can stand up to Donald Trump, you can stand up to the Daily Mail. So I just find myself now jettisoning or recognizing those four tribes, right? and wondering who is left. You're not a Corbynite who thinks that Starmer is the Antichrist. You're not a Starmerite who thinks that Starmer is the Antichrist. You're not a Starmerite who thinks that Starmer is the Messiah. You're not a two-tier racist who doesn't really know what you think, but you hate whatever you've been told to hate today. You're Orwell's, actually, creatures, aren't you? Or you're the sort of slightly more middle-class version of that, which is terrified that unidentified individuals or institutions are going to come for what you have. Who's left? Answer, people who aren't in a tribe. Maybe, I don't know, centrist is a tribe, isn't it? But I don't know which of those four camps. Who's left? The tribeless? The dispossessed? The politically homeless? No. People who are Labour or Tory are perfectly capable of forming interesting opinions about what has happened in the last few days. But it was Ollie Robbins yesterday. It was as if the man I thought, and when I say a grown-up, I mean process. I thought he was just going to do things right. So even if he got it wrong, or even if things weren't perfect, he's just going to do things right. He's not going to cut corners. He's not going to pass bucks. He's not going to be economical with the actuality. He's not going to play games. Yeah, I saw him standing across the House of Commons from Boris Johnson, and I thought I saw chalk and cheese. But as Ian Dunt writes in the iNewspaper today, Starmer has squandered his advantage. Unbelievably, he can now be compared to Johnson. And in some ways he can, because this is finagling. This is sharp practice. This is moving the goalposts, changing the story, passing the buck. Ending up with Ollie Robbins, who conducted himself yesterday with dignity and sympathy, empathy. I felt sorry for the man. He's lost his job for doing his job. The idea that he should have done more or could have done more doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. The idea that Keir Starmer would have banjaxed the entire appointment of Peter Mandelson if he'd been told about the questionable vetting result, that doesn't stand up to scrutiny either, I'm afraid, because they'd already got the king to announce it, which explains why so much pressure was brought to bear upon the Foreign Office to clear the appointment. So, is it unrealistic of me, unwise of me, or unfair of me to ask people who are in none of those tribes, you're not a Corbynite, a Starmerite, a two-tier racist, or a Daily Mail bigot, to answer the question of whether you currently think Keir Starmer is up to this job? And, crucially, what the events of the last few days have done to your answer to that question. And this is not a conversation about, well, who is going to replace him, or who is doing this, or who is doing that, or the sharpening of the knives. It's just a question about you, actually. You, as a non-member of any of the tribes we've identified, and if I've missed any tribes, feel free to stick them on the list. He got Iran right, of course he did. But as Emily Thornberry has said overnight, he seemed to be digging himself out of a hole by getting Iran right, and now he's fallen straight back into it. And Emily Thornberry is a Labour MP on the centre of the party. She's not a fascist or a fully paid-up member of the two-tier Keir racist club. She's not, certainly not a Corbynite. She's not a Starmerite. She's called it correctly. She's the chair of the committee that took Ollie Robbins' evidence yesterday. So, is he up to the job? Convince me that he is. Because today it just doesn't look like he can do this. He can't turn this round. And if he can't turn it round, then the argument for getting somebody else in place sooner becomes irresistible. And I've been here before. A couple of times. I've been on the precipice that I'm teetering across now thinking. Because it's a massive thing to think. We've got PTSD, I think. Decent people in this country, people who saw that Brexit was awful, people who saw that Boris Johnson was awful, people who saw that Donald Trump was awful, people who saw that Liz Truss was awful. We've got PTSD. I'm not underplaying the seriousness of that condition when you've sustained it in warfare or something like that, but we've got a mild form of post-traumatic stress disorder because we need peace, stability, calm, quiet. And we thought Keir Starmer would provide it. And he hasn't. Call it political trauma, stress disorder. And it's continuing now. And it is Keir Starmer's fault. It just is, isn't it? 0345 6060 973. If your answer to this question has changed since he became Prime Minister, then I want to hear your take on this. And if it hasn't changed, but you are persuaded, you are convinced that your arguments are as solid as houses, then I want to hear from you as well. Is he actually up to the job? 03 is post-Tory stress disorder. There it is. Post-Tory stress disorder. Right? And Keir Starmer isn't curing it. And that is a problem for me. Is it a problem for you? Or, if it's not, can you help me through my recovery? Good Lord, is that the time? The number you need is 0345 6060 973. Hit the numbers now. You will get through. I need your help with this, especially if you're not in any of those tribes.
LBC. Time to bring your out-of-date kitchen up to date. Wix has over 80 kitchen styles, so you can find the perfect one. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
If you were missold a home on a holiday park, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive compensation. Text ADVICE to 78900.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
The following is from TfL.
My name was Luna, like the moon. I was 2 days short of my 17th birthday when I was killed. My killer wasn't a bad man. He had a rescue dog called Frank and rang his mum every Sunday. He wasn't a speed freak. He just thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit. But that was enough to knock me off my bike and kill me.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
I'm Will Buxton.
I'm Naomi Schiff.
I'm David Coulthard.
And I'm Jolie Shaw.
This is Up to Speed. Available every Monday and Thursday on Global Player or wherever you get your podcasts.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
26 minutes after 10. I don't know that we've missed any tribes, but... it's the opposite of what you're supposed to do when you present a phone-in programme. I mean, more interested in minds that change, minds that are capable of changing, people that respond to evidence by reviewing their own position. The traditional medium is just to sort of shout the odds and invite people to ring in for... You could do this job for 25 years and not change your mind about anything if you were possessed of a very peculiar and particular type of brain. The same brain you need to be a columnist in a tabloid newspaper, but... Equally, you can't be blowing in the wind like a weather vane. You've got to have convictions, and you've got to have evidence to back those convictions up. I thought Keir Starmer was solid, safe, and he isn't. I think he's a good man, and I think he's done some really good things. I think that the historians of the future will assess his handling of the Iran crisis as being exemplary. I think it is a textbook display from a Prime Minister aware of the lessons of Chilcot. But I'm afraid that this latest scandal, and I've changed my mind now about it twice, but it was Ollie Robbins talking yesterday about what he presides over that made me think he's just not very good at this. He is not up to this job. Listen, I spent years being passionately opposed to Donald Trump and waiting for him to suddenly shed the hideousness that seemed to typify his politics and become something more normal, waiting for him to become president, as all the right-wing papers would write. Today is the day he became the president, and it never happened. So I'm not giving up on Keir Starmer necessarily at this stage in proceedings, but I am, I think, the furthest I've ever been from a position of confidence and or support. So where are you? Steer me back, if you want, to where I have been before, or confirm my conviction, my fear, that where we are now is the land of denial. And I don't mean Egypt. Tala is in Rossendale. Tala, what would you like to say?
Hi, James.
Hello, mate.
In the run-up to the election,
I had my doubts about Starmer, especially when he threw Bengalis under the bus unfairly, I think. But then I was under the impression that, okay, every sort of politician takes their opportunities, and although it's fair, he probably is going to steer the ship. Since then, everything just seems to me to be placating certain groups because he seems scared almost. And because of that, it just seems like he is sort of letting everyone down. And then this recent thing, to me, it just seems, you know, he doesn't take responsibility, he doesn't take accountability. Everything that happens, everything he does, it seems to be opportunism, if that makes sense.
It's a weird one. I have to guard myself against pushing back too hard against things on mornings like this, because I haven't got really firm position myself. I don't. Is he an opportunist? I mean, that's quite a nasty word. Boris Johnson was an opportunist. I don't see Starmer as an opportunist. I see it as a bit weaker than that, almost. It's as if he is easily blown in the wind, as opposed to always being in it for himself or looking for the main chance.
I think you're right. I think opportunist, what I mean by opportunist is that he caves to pressure, I think. Not that necessarily he is this sort of malignant individual who he's in there because he wants to be some, you know, career politician who's there for however long. I think for me, it's just that he seems terrified of everything, I think.
Yeah, I think
especially with Trump. He seems terrified of Trump.
But I push back slightly on that. I was about to agree with you, but he has stood up to Trump in a way that is impressive and absolutely distinguishes himself from all the other party. Well, not Ed Davey, but it absolutely distinguishes him from Badenoch or from Farage, who might be changing their story now, but they made it pretty clear that had they been in power when Donald Trump launched his illegal war against, his ludicrous war against Iran alongside Benjamin Netanyahu, then they'd have been in lockstep and almost certainly sending anything that Donald Trump asked for in return. So that takes some guts, that takes some backbone. I'm not for a minute suggesting that he is without qualities, just that the qualities he's got are not enough for the job. 10:31 is the time. And I think it's fair to say Talha clearly isn't in any of the tribes that I've identified who, and you know, there's an awful lot of different opinions in those four tribes, but I think what you all have in common is close to an inability to change your mind about anything, up to and including Keir Starmer. Here's Lottie Morley anyway with your headlines.
The Chancellor says her number one priority is to keep costs down after UK inflation rose in the year to March. The increase from 3 to 3.3% was mostly driven by an increase in fuel prices because of the war in Iran. Sir Keir Starmer is expected to come under pressure at PMQs later about the appointment of Peter Mandelson. The UK's former top civil servant told MPs yesterday he was under constant pressure from Number 10 to hire him as US ambassador. And President Trump has announced an extension to the US ceasefire with Iran. He says the move is to allow Tehran to come up with a unified proposal for peace. LBC weather, dry and settled with sunny spells for most of the UK this afternoon, a high of 17 degrees.
This is LBC. Time to bring your out-of-date kitchen up to date. Wix has over 80 kitchen styles, so you can find the perfect one. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. Or wobbly, or wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxing.
George is up the ribbon can without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby.
Download the Thames Link Railway app to book advanced single tickets from London St Pancras to Cambridge from only £11. Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply.
At Lidl, we're giving you 50% off a fruit or veg item on your next shop. Just scan the Lidl Plus app at checkout, and when you scan, you'll be in with a chance to win your whole shop back. Open Lidl Plus and start saving today. Lidl, more to value. 18 plus GB residents, various prices available, subject to availability, end 30th of 5th, 26. Full T's and C's apply. See lidl.co.uk/lp-terms.
Go all Irish to France with great low prices. With Irish Ferries, you can for less. Irish Ferries, see travel differently. T's and C's apply.
Notice the change in your hearing? Well, get a hearing check from Specsavers. Oh, not sure where to start? Well, we're very flexible. Book one online, on the phone, on your lunch break, on Saturdays, on the same day if you're lucky. Oh, you only miss the odd word. But what if the odd words you're missing are nice ones like love you, or important ones like duck? Oh, too expensive, is it? All right, we like you. We'll do it for nothing. For free hearing checks, should have gone to Specsavers.
Fevertree Ginger Beer. There's no one quite like you, is there? That fiery character. Warming undertones. Mixed, you make a spirited Moscow Mule. But even on your own, you still have the most delectable kick. Fevertree. Straight up or mixed. It's a matter of taste.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It is 10:34, not for the first time. Ian Dunn puts it better than I can. Starmer was opposition leader during Boris Johnson's time in office. He seemed genuinely outraged that someone of Johnson's personal defects should be prime minister, that British politics was dominated by tiresome who-said-what gibberish at a moment of national decline. But by behaving this way, he has been forced, Starmer has been forced into precisely the same position and for no discernible gain. Starmer was a man with a reputation for integrity and decency. Allies and opponents agreed that he was fundamentally honourable and motivated by public service. But, and this is exactly where I am this morning, I hope I'm not here forever, but if I am, I need to make my mind up pretty quickly. His recent behaviour makes a mockery of that reputation. Instead of taking responsibility for his actions, he blames others. Instead of admitting his error, he blames a culture he himself helped create. And I'm afraid all the whining, and I use that word as a whiner, I'm a fellow whiner, all the whining about right-wing media or about the lack of scrutiny of Richard Tice's tax affairs or Boris Johnson's security status or Nigel Farage's mysterious house in Clacton, all of the whining about that doesn't change the simple fact that he is blaming others and instead of admitting an error, he is blaming a culture he himself helped create. Best explained like this, right? Number 10 made it clear that they wanted Mandelson in Washington no matter what. The Foreign Office ensured that Mandelson went to Washington. And now, after it emerged that Mandelson should never have been allowed anywhere near Washington, Ollie Robbins has been handed the can. And, indeed, his sandwich is wrapped in a roadmap. And that is unfair, unkind, and very much at odds with that reputation for integrity and decency that saw many of us hoped that he would mark the end of PTSD, post-Tory stress disorder. Nicholas is in Amsterdam. Nicholas, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. How are you doing?
I'm all good. What's on your mind?
Well, I as I told your producer, I tend to disagree with you slightly. This is my first time calling. I live in Amsterdam. I follow a lot of UK politics, but
I like this. An American in Holland, an American in the Netherlands. It's a perspective. It's probably rare, but I'm fascinated to hear it.
And I by no means do I consider myself to be an expert, obviously, on UK politics.
Sure.
But I do listen to your program and have.
Well, then you're
decade,
an expert.
So.
Then you know more than most of this country. Carry on, Nicholas.
Okay. Well, coming from the United States, it's been a frequent occurrence where the president will nominate somebody for a position, say it out loud, present them to the U.S. Senate, and then something comes along in vetting where that has to be rescinded. Now, the president's not the king, but you said this morning that the prime minister had the king announce this, and it seemed like a foregone conclusion. Where I come from, it's not a foregone conclusion.
You ain't got a king, mate.
Well,
so
exactly.
the constitutional crisis that would be evinced by a king making an announcement and then a prime minister having to say, oh, I'm terribly sorry, seems we've made a terrible mistake. You're going to have to unannounce that. Is and I don't want to sound post-colonial, but it is probably something that the American political system can't accommodate or process.
Yes, it's certainly a little bit different. I mean, and perhaps even a lot different, right? But
yes.
But the notion of the scrutiny occurring after the announcement is not a strange occurrence. In fact, it's quite normal. It's normal in the president's cabinet and his staffers doing the analysis, and then of course Congress has to do it themselves. So withdrawing a nomination is considered somewhat rote, or at least normal. And I understand there's greater pressure when the prime minister may have to do it in the UK versus the president. But that's where I say it falls onto the civil service, not the prime minister. And that's where I think the prime minister, while he's not my favorite prime minister, and in fact, 2 months ago, I thought that he should probably be resigning.
Right.
I do not think that this row still amounts to something where he should resign. And in fact, I think Sir Ollie Robbins was... I think he should have been sacked to be perfectly honest, having watched his testimony yesterday.
I mean, we're coming at this from slightly different angles. I don't think this is a resignation issue. This is a culmination question for me. This is a, you know, an accumulation of issues. And I would disagree with you about the Ollie Robbins thing. I think that sacking him was particularly unfair. But again, more details might emerge in the coming days or the coming weeks. But the crucial question is whether or not this is a big enough straw to break the camel's back. Not is this a big enough issue to break the camel's back alone. And obviously you don't think it is.
But
I don't, just to be clear, I don't think it's a resignation issue. But it is that line there about passing the buck, about not doing the process, about essentially creating a system, and then blaming the system for what happened. That I don't know that you can get off that particular hook, Nicholas.
So that's where I look at this as Sir Ollie Robbins was in the position to make the determinant as to whether this should go forward or not.
Yes.
And he said in his testimony that he felt overwhelming pressure to approve it.
Yes.
While simultaneously saying he did not bow to pressure. And those two statements are somewhat incompatible.
Yeah, I give you that. They are.
You either, if you felt the pressure and you ignored it, then how did you end up at the result that this was a risk worth managing because the prime minister is pressuring me? That doesn't make any sense to me, and that's where I see the responsibility falling on Ollie Robbins, not so much on the prime minister. And I would even posit that the prime minister has taken responsibility, and I would posit he's taken responsibility repeatedly for the nomination in the first place. I think he has said that I should have known better from the outset, and that is my fault. Right. But yes. I also should have been told about this process that rendered Lord Mandelson to pass vetting without actually passing vetting. That's the part where I think it's right and proper for the prime minister.
I'm loving this because you've been paying attention and there's a couple of things. The first one I think is going to be cultural and we won't agree on that. I think you underestimate the significance of this announcement being made by the king before the vetting had been complete. And it is an announcement rendered inevitable by the enthusiasm for the appointment that number 10 was displaying. And that enthusiasm is also what created the pressure that Ollie Robbins thought he was under. Your points about simultaneously being under pressure and resisting pressure, he maintains that he made the right decision, that stands. But if he made the right decision, which he did under both his own reading and if you like precedent, then why did he get fired? He got fired because of the Epstein connection that emerged after the appointment. That is what has embarrassed the Prime Minister. That is why the Prime Minister is apologising forever appointing him in the first place. What we learned yesterday was that the vetting was not called into question as a consequence of Mandelson's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. It was called into question as a consequence of unspecified associations through either personal or business connections, in my opinion, almost certainly with either China, Chinese players, Russian players, or both. So Ollie Robbins looked at that evidence and said, it's okay, we can go ahead. He hasn't been sacked for that. He's been sacked because of the public perception that Mandelson never should have been in the job because of his associations with Epstein. So however you dice it, Nicholas, I put it to you that Robbins has been appallingly treated.
Maybe I missed something in the news yesterday.
I
might have skipped something.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. I apologize.
Because I think you missed the bit about what the vetting revealed and the categorical denial that it had anything to do with Epstein. So if Epstein hadn't happened, Mandelson would still be in the job. And yet the vetting was failed.
That's true, but
the vetting was failed for completely different reasons. And he's been fired because of the Epstein angle. There it is. We've got it. You've helped me get there, but that's the absolute crux of the matter.
Okay. I still don't agree, but I...
You have to agree. It's just true. This isn't an opinion. It's counting. You have to agree. Well, there's no way he would have been fired if the associations with Epstein hadn't been reinflated and reignited a few months ago.
But the issue with the vetting...
I'm going to stop talking. Sorry.
No, the issue to me, and again, this might be my misinterpretation, but the issue that as I see it and as I've heard it and I've read it and what have you, is that the issue with the vetting, regardless of what the issue was, whether it was Epstein, whether it was China, whether it was Russia, has to do with the prime minister not being fully informed of a failure in the vetting. Now, maybe this all became to light because of Epstein, and that may well be true, but Ollie Robbins, in my opinion, was tasked with making a decision as to recommend this, or basically to stamp this person's nomination for this diplomatic rank to the United States. And Ollie Robbins said yes. And at that point in time, when there were clear national security, let alone pedophile issues.
No, but there weren't any. There weren't any pedophile issues. They were not part of the vet. We did learn that. I think you did miss that. That was stated yesterday.
I must have missed that part.
In committee. So the vetting failure is not about Epstein. And I'm not going to give any ground on the conclusion you've led me to, that the sacking of Ollie Robbins was all about Epstein. Even though he's never going to say so. Starmer is sitting there tearing his hair out that he was ever daft enough, stupid enough, craven enough, advised, misled, cajoled into appointing Mandelson when it was already in the public domain that he had maintained contact with Epstein after conviction. Level, extent of contact perhaps not fully appreciated, but the existence of continuing contact was known. He's sitting there going, what the hell happened? How did I do that? I can answer that question. I think partly because it was such a widely, warmly greeted appointment that they kind of dialed down the care and concern and the due diligence that they would normally display. Everyone loves it. Oh, let's just relax about it. Even the Epstein stuff. Well, everyone knows about the Epstein stuff, so they don't seem untrapped. So let's just crack on with the appointment. He's sitting there in 2020 hindsight, benefit of retrospect, going, what the fudge were we doing? How did we ever send Mandelson to DC? I mean, what were we doing? And then this story comes along. And he failed the vetting. Right, let's sack someone. Because the emotion inside him was created by the Epstein scandal. And the outlet for that emotion was the sacking of Ollie Robbins, who was in the firing line because of a completely different set of circumstances. And that is why Ollie Robbins has been abominably treated. Because he's been fired because of Peter Mandelson's associations with Jeffrey Epstein, which were known to Keir Starmer when he appointed him to the job. And that, Nicholas, is the end of my TED talk.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
I think it does terminal damage to this image of the Prime Minister as a fastidious, careful, process-driven lawyer with an eye for detail. I think it does a serious amount of damage to the idea that while, yes, it's a very difficult job, this being Prime Minister business, that Starmer is actually a decent bloke. I don't think he is. I think he has knowingly attempted to bury someone to save his own skin.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
At Pets in a Pickle, we know your furry friends get up to all kinds of mischief. Like when the dog scuffed that entire chocolate cake. Or the time the cat tested his 9 lives from the curtain rail. Again. That's why we're here when it matters most, with fuss-free pet insurance policies, including unlimited video call access with First Vet. For pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
The following is from TFL.
I got loads of flowers the other day, and messages from people I didn't even know. My mates spelled out my name in tea lights, and my mom hung my favourite footy shirt on the railings, next to the lamppost, where I got killed. By a nice lady, just someone who thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
Notice the change in your hearing? Well, get a hearing check from Specsavers. Oh, not sure where to start? Well, we're very flexible. Book one online, on the phone, on your lunch break, on Saturdays, on the same day if you're lucky. Oh, you only miss the odd word. But what if the odd words you're missing are nice ones like love you or important ones like duck? Oh, too expensive, is it? All right. We like you. We'll do it for nothing. For free hearing checks, should have gone to Specsavers.
How does a $20 golf gadget end up being used as a bomb detector in war zones worldwide? I'm Alice Levine, and this is Explosive Lies, the podcast exposing a scam that fooled governments and security services across the globe. Open our free Global Player app and search Explosive Lies to start listening today.
Calling all young creatives. Kickstart your career in media. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12 at Global Academy. GlobalAcademy.com.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 6060973.
10:49. Listen, I can't provide a bespoke response to every misinterpretation that comes into the studio, but if you're questioning what I said about Epstein and Mandelson's relationship being in the public domain, the continuing relationship after the conviction, as a couple of you are, then you really need to Google or just do the most cursory research. I don't want to sound condescending, but to go to the trouble of texting me to say, you're wrong, it wasn't in the public domain. And Jim Pickard was reporting in the Financial Times in January of 2024 that Mandelson stayed at Jeffrey Epstein's Manhattan townhouse while Epstein was in prison. And the idea that this wasn't in the public domain already is, I'm afraid, ridiculous. And it doesn't reflect well on you. And you've now wasted 90 seconds of my program while I've had to set you straight. But it was the emails that emerged in February that really blew up that contact, that connection. It didn't reveal the contact or the connection. It just blew it up because they were so slimy. And that is when the appointment of Mandelson started to look abominable. And that is when Keir Starmer started having conniptions or a fit of the vapors. And that is why the appetite to do something when the next story emerged about the vetting failures resulted in the almost immediate sacking of the man who had done what he was told to do and helped Keir Starmer get Mandelson into the embassy in Washington, D.C., something that was announced in full knowledge that the vetting had not been completed. So I'm afraid, however you dice it, you can't paint this as anything other than bad, all right? We can argue about how bad, but it's really bad, in my view, and it gets worse when you add it to the already fairly long charge list. And yes, there's other stuff on the other side of the scales, most obviously and most recently, brilliant handling of Iran and of Trump. But he sacked Ollie Robbins because he was kicking himself over appointing Mandelson, and that is petulant, it is peevish, and it is profoundly unfair. And if you can just loosen your scarf for long enough to let the blood reach your brain, you'll realise that I'm right, he says with characteristic arrogance. Lloyd's in Lewisham. Lloyd, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. I normally agree with you on everything.
Oh, dear.
I don't often call. I believe that Starmer was aware of what risk he was taking. And he took the risk, merely for what he believed was good of the country.
Yeah.
But if that risk blows up, it's entirely on him.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, you said, well, there you go. You thought you disagreed with me. Turns out we agree about this as well.
Yeah, so I don't think all this stuff about him being blindsided, not being told things. He's an intelligent man. He knows the risk. He believes the risk was worth it. It didn't work out. You carry the can. Whether that means resigning or whatever you've got to do, I know, full of
Disagree about whether or not this is itself a resignation issue, but we agree that he shouldn't have sacked Ollie Robbins.
Oh, well, definitely agree with that. I don't know whether he should resign or not. I think if he had approached things in the right way, it wouldn't be a resign issue. I think when the appointment was first made, which was a bit hard to do, I know, you kind of acknowledge this is a risk I'm taking for the good of the country. And then maybe he would have had it out. But I think the way he's gone about it, especially up to now, I can't see how he can have that label of being a man of integrity anymore.
No, and this is the problem, isn't it? It may be that he's been pushed into this position by events and that he is... if we were to somehow get a bead on his actual character, the DNA of his personality, the integrity would be plain to see. But he has turned it off for the duration of this episode. And some of his critics would argue for other episodes as well. And other critics would argue that it was never there in the first place. For the avoidance of doubt, I think he is an honourable man. I think he has been, I think he has failed to reach for his integrity when it was needed. And just for the avoidance of doubt, thank you, Lloyd, let's pop back to January of 2024, when Jim Pickard of the Financial Times joined us as he was embarking upon a very well-mannered and measured lap of honour, given that the subject matter is so grim, when the rest of the world finally caught up with what he was doing in 2024.
The FT did a report this summer on a JP Morgan report which suggested that Peter Mandelson had stayed at the New York townhouse of Jeffrey Epstein in 2009 when he was de facto deputy prime minister and while the financier was imprisoned for soliciting prostitution from a minor. Do you think that Lord Mandelson, who is of course a close political ally of yours, has some questions to answer?
On Peter Mandelson, look, in... And I do try to give pretty full answers in these sessions. I don't know any more than you do. And therefore, there's not really much I can add to what you already know, I'm afraid. And, you know, that's simply the state of the affairs. Thank you, Jim.
Not really much of an answer, was it? Although, of course, 2020 hindsight is a wonderful thing. But I just want to clarify that anybody sending me messages saying, for example, it wasn't in the public domain that he maintained contact. It was classified in the Epstein files, come on, man, as somebody had the audacity, the effrontery to send to me. Then there it is. You haven't been paying attention. That's not my fault. I can only go so far. I can explain things to you. I cannot understand them for you. Kate's in Camden. Kate, what do you reckon?
Hello, James.
Hello,
yeah, thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Keir Starmer is not just my PM, he's my local MP.
Oh.
And he was very successful, in my view anyway, as a local MP. He helped me personally on several occasions with some serious issues, good. And also other people within the community. Never looked for praise for it or anything like that, you know. And I just think he just wasn't ready or prepared to be thrust into the position of Prime Minister. I really don't
think
he was.
It's a sad conclusion that you've reached, I sense.
Yeah.
You are sad to reach that conclusion.
I am sad. I liked him. I liked him. I like him very much. Yeah. I've met him on many occasions, and I think he's a very nice and very honourable man. But soon after, I voted for Labour. Soon afterwards, with the business, I'm 72 and I had long COVID, just to explain.
Yes.
Soon after the election, with the cutting of the winter fuel allowance and then going for the disabled, I was so hugely, not just disappointed, but bewildered.
Shock.
As to why they would do that. And I did email him and say, what are you thinking of? Mm. You know, this is madness. You're a Labour party, not you're the Prime Minister of a Labour party. You're not Tory Mike too. I've had occasion to email him on several occasions since. I have been very disappointed with his performance.
And what about the latest episode?
Yes. Well, because in between that, there was the I was very happy with him. When he kept us out of Trump's war.
Yes.
I thought that was a great decision. With the latest decision, I think this kind of highlights the fact that he just wasn't ready to take on this huge role that people are probably pressuring him.
Who would be? Because I've got a couple of messages that are tilting at the same windmill. This is from Matt, who's in Durham. Have we made the job of Prime Minister impossible? Brexit, COVID, austerity, Trump, social media. And Paul in North Yorkshire, half an hour previously, sent me a message saying, is anyone up to the job, James?
Well, that's a good question. Keir Starmer, his life was in law, you know. He was a barrister and then he was head of CPS and so on. And in a sense, he's kind of a new boy to politics.
Yes.
And it was on the lower level, you know, when he was a local MP, And that, but
I don't know what is the apprenticeship
between that.
Yes, no, of course there is, and I think you're being very generous actually, because I think in these moments, and if we were to really boil it down to the absolute essence of this story, this combination of stories, he should never have sent Peter Mandelson to Washington. And everything that follows from that is consequence, not action. He should never have... And when you hear Jim Pickard asking that question, he stayed in his house when he was in prison. He was so untroubled by the original conviction that he stayed in his house, sending him emails, offering sympathy and support even as he was convicted. And, of course, that was the mother of all plea deals. And Peter Mandelson is many things, but stupid he ain't. Or ignorant of the news, or not au fait with current affairs and recent developments. He is not. He is absolutely across all of it. Took a view, for whatever reason, to stand by the man. To stand by his friend. And all roads lead back to that. And everything that comes from that is just horrible.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, inflation has risen following a sharp rise in fuel prices due to the war in Iran. The Consumer Prices Index rose to 3.3% last month from 3% in February. The deputy leader of the Liberal Democrats, Daisy Cooper, has told LBC Donald Trump is to blame.
And it means more pain for families in terms of the cost in their pocket and the cost at the fuel pump. This is a direct result of Trumpflation, a direct result of Trump's illegal actions in Iran that were cheered on by the Conservatives and Reform UK. Cheering on that war simply means higher prices at the fuel pump and in the supermarket.
Chancellor Rachel Reeves says her number one priority is to keep costs down. At least three ships have been hit by gunfire in the Strait of Hormuz. Maritime security sources have confirmed the crews are safe and there has been no environmental impact. Donald Trump announced this morning he would extend a ceasefire deal with Iran. Former diplomat Alan Eyre says the announcement could give both sides space to come up with a viable peace plan.
We've got some more time for Pakistan to work its magic. Hopefully we get these two people in the same country, in the same room, and they can start working out at least an interim framework agreement that gives space for a possible solution.
It's emerged that homelessness has contributed to the deaths of more than 100 children in England over the past 6 years. Official figures show 76 of those deaths were of babies under the age of one. The government says it's working to eradicate poor quality accommodation linked to a number of cases. England's Children's Commissioner has raised concerns about continued strip searches of young people by police. The number has halved since 2020, but Dame Rachel D'Souza says still too many are unnecessary and unsafe. The Home Office says it's introducing reforms to drive up policing standards. And stargazers could see as many as 100 shooting stars an hour tonight. The annual Lyrid meteor shower will peak this evening. It'll be most visible in northern parts of the UK. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 3 points at 10,501. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, dry and settled with sunny spells for most of the UK. Some outbreaks of rain in the northeast and southwest. A high of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 3 minutes after 11. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Sometimes the attention that you pay or that I pay to a headline depends upon the newspaper that it appears in. But despite appearing in a hideous newspaper, this statistic appears to be solid. Half of under 30s would not fight for their country under any circumstances, a poll has revealed. Right. Caveat number one. This is conducted by the University of Glasgow, sponsored by Nationwide, and is part of the UK Youth Poll. So, caveat number one, you know, if people dressed as stormtroopers, and I'm thinking of Nazis now, not Darth Vader, were marching up Pall Mall, then I imagine that some of the young people currently persuaded that they would never fight for their country would give their heads a wobble and sign up immediately. It's about the perception of threat, but it's also about the perception of what is worth protecting. And this is something that I think is massively underpriced in current conversations, partly because they're dominated by old gits like me. If you look at that neat statistic that I am enduringly fascinated and heartbroken by, and then on, and that's on a personal level, but on a professional level, I am eternally frustrated by my failure to get to the heart of the issue. I've tried and tried and tried again. Last time we did it, phone lines lit up like a Christmas tree, and with the greatest of love and respect to everybody that contributed, we didn't get it. We didn't get any closer to the truth than on all the days when I haven't managed to light the switchboard up like a Christmas tree in pursuit of the answer to the question of why nearly a million young people are not doing anything in this country. Part of the problem, of course, is that there will be many answers to that question. Maybe not quite a million, but there will be many answers to that question. There is not a Rosetta Stone or a skeleton key that unlocks the whole issue, but there must be some fairly hefty consensus in certain groups as to why so many young people are not doing anything. They're not in education, employment, or training. And I think that these two stories are practically conjoined. I think these two stories are absolutely inextricably intertwined. This sense of it not being worth it. So the closest I've got to a theory on NEETs, young people not in education, employment or training, the closest I've got to a theory on this, and I have not backed it up, I'm afraid, with either your anecdotal evidence or with data, because it is impossible to get the data that you need to arrive at the conclusions that you want. But here's my theory, and feel free to pick it apart, or even, should you be minded, to give it a thumbs up, a metaphorical thumbs up. I think, and I'm about to become a parent with no children at school for the first time in the best part of 20 years. But I think that young people leave school and carry on living exactly the same life that they were living before, but without the school bit. So I think they carry on living in the same bedroom and having their dinner at the same table or in front of the same TV, living with mum or dad or both, and just living on the same amount of money, the same amount of income that they had when they were at school, maybe a little bit of cash being made on the side through some internet trading or a similar or maybe slightly more nefarious activity. And they just carry on. And it is a temporary arrangement until it isn't. And for most of these young people, this is where the statistics can be misleading. For most of these young people, it is a temporary arrangement, but by the time they move on to do education, employment or training, there is a new cohort of young people, because it happens every year, coming up behind them to fill in the gaps that they've created by moving on and or moving out, of course. They might be moving into a different age group, or they might be moving into education, employment or training. But their place will then be filled by the next generation of teenagers. And the reason why they do this, the reason why this happens, and this must be one of the hardest things in the world for some people to understand if you haven't got children of the relevant age or your privilege is such that you can't see this particular wood for the trees, is that they cannot see the point in doing anything else. So, yes, there might be a job available, but you are not going to earn enough money to make a meaningful change to the life that I've just described. You are not, for example, going to be able to leave home. If you look at rents now, particularly in the southeast, I suppose, but elsewhere as well, you look at rents, you look at what is needed without seeking state support, then you're not going to have anything left. if you're on the national living wage and you're paying an average rent, you look at those numbers. Why would I do that? So why don't you work and then carry on living at home? Well, because, again, I mean, what am I going to do? I'm going to have a few more quids, but I'm probably never going to be able to save enough to get a deposit on a house. And I quite like my life now. I don't like it, but I've just... And lockdown sort of taught us all that we can actually just stay in bed all day, or we can actually never leave the house. We can actually live... I'm not advising you to pursue this course. I'm trying to understand the people that have. Lockdown sort of caught us by surprise in what we learned from it without realising what we were learning. And this is a generation of people who learned that, well, you don't have to join the rat race. If you can opt out of there, I mean, what was furlough? I know you got your money, but a lot of people didn't, and we almost all survived. So what's the point? I'm still sleeping in the same bed. I'm still eating the same food. I'm still watching the same programs. I'm still joshing with the same parent or parents. I'm still living the same life I led when I was at school. I just haven't got the inconvenience of having to go to school. And you might slide back into that after getting your A-levels and thinking they'd be a boost into something else and then discovering that they weren't. You might have gone off to university and then come back thinking your degree would open doors to you, but the only doors it's going to open are not big enough doors to justify leaving the door that you're currently living behind. This is the closest I've got. I think technically you're right. It's a hypothesis, not a theory. But this is the closest I've got to an answer to the question of how we've got nearly a million young people who are currently not in education, employment or training. And the answer is that they cannot see the point. They cannot see the point. You can shout at them all you want. You can talk about, I don't know, national service and press gangs and, they don't know they're born. But you should really be feeling incredibly sorry for them. So we've stolen something from them. Not consciously or deliberately. And sometimes we've stolen it through our political choices. Unintentionally. But in some ways we have taken hope from them, or hope has been taken from them. And I can't read this story about a half of under-30s who would not fight for their country under any circumstances without thinking of the million young people who are currently not in education, employment or training. Because, and I mean this, it's not a question I have ever contemplated before. What would they be fighting for? 03456060973. I want you, if you're in this category, if you're under 30 and you don't think, you cannot conceive of circumstances in which you would risk your life for this country, then I really want to hear from you about A, why you think that is, and B, where you sit on my analysis. They're looking at wages, affordable housing and career opportunities as things that make them feel detached from society. And I am going to struggle to argue with them. It's not laziness, because that's such an easy... We're all quite lazy. And yet the equation that we're offered at that age is that the rewards will outweigh the temptation to stay in bed all day. I watched, just by complete coincidence, that final Kevin and Perry scene when Kevin finally gets a girlfriend and he comes downstairs the next morning and he's turned into the son of the year. He's like, hello, mother, would you care? Would you like some help with the shopping? Hello, father, should we go to the football this afternoon? And Perry, of course, is still stuck in adolescent mode and he's got a girlfriend it's not laziness. It's just, what am I supposed to be doing instead? Well, you're supposed to be going to work and getting a job. Okay, why? Because then you'll get this and you'll get that, except, you won't. My first lesson in my day-itis was to do with house prices. When I would take calls, and I think I was probably quite rude to these people at the time, which was a bit disrespectful to my elders, but I was probably on the right tip. Oh, young people today, they don't know they're born. They don't. I worked three jobs, or we did that. And all you do is you say to people, what did you earn? And they'll say, well, I earned £1,500 a year in 1960. And what did your house cost? £3,500. What's 3,500 divided by 1,500? Well, two point something. And guess what it is now? The income of these kids is, say, 30 grand, and the average house is 300 grand. I'm generalising. And what's 300 divided by 30? Even Keith can do that. You're right. Both hands, Keith. It's 10. So why draw comparisons? Why pretend that the lessons you learned when you were their age have any relevance whatsoever to what they're facing now? Because it is, by definition, 3, 4, 5 times harder for them to get on the housing ladder than it was for you. And spoiler alert, if you had the financial situation you had then now, you wouldn't be getting on the housing ladder. You might not even be able to afford to rent anywhere. And if you can't afford to rent anywhere, you might as well stay at home. Because what is the point of schlepping your guts out for national living wage or minimum wage or a little bit more if the rewards at the end of that particular tunnel are pitiful? And now they want you to go to war. To defend what? So we'll do both conversations. I'll take calls on the NEETs and I'll take calls on the war. Because I don't think you can separate one from the other. Any questions that have prompted themselves in your mind already that you're minded to answer, I'll take your call. 03456060973. But at the heart of this question, it's almost like the polar opposite of shinning up a lamppost to hang a flag outside the house of somebody who doesn't want you to. At the heart of this question, what would you be fighting for? What would they be fighting for? So, if you're in this cohort, if you're under 30 and you would fight for your country, or if you're under 30 and you would not fight for your country under any circumstances, I wonder if you would mind having a crack at telling the rest of us why not. And as for the rest of us, because we're older or we're, I don't know, safer, what? Look them in the eye. Look this lad in the eye or this young lady in the eye. They say to you, I'm not fighting for this country under any circumstances. And you tell them why they should. Right, in the absence of a specific enemy, it's easy to say because otherwise you'd be living under this or you'd be living under that. I want to know what they're fighting for, not what they're fighting against. It's a crucial distinction. It's why the Second World War is actually really unhelpful in many conversations about matters military, because it was pretty close to a fight between good and evil. Most wars aren't like that. Most wars are because, I don't know, a couple of cousins have fallen out, or somebody wants more taxes, so they're going to try and take over some territory in order to get the taxes from that territory. The Second World War, certainly in retrospect, even if it didn't seem so at the time, was a battle between good and evil. You knew what you were fighting for, and you knew what you were fighting against. But today, in the absence of an identified enemy, what would these young people be fighting for? Look them in the eye and tell them you've got to fight for your country because, what? 0345 6060 97. Keith, look at the time. So, I know it's a bit late, but goodness me, it's way earlier than we've done for about, what, a year and a half? Yeah, now I'm making it even later by drawing attention to how not late I am, despite actually being late.
This is LBC.
There comes a time in your life when you need to make a change, to start a new chapter. It's time to consider a residential park home bungalow from Ecos Group. Castleview Court in Pevensey is a peaceful gated community for those aged over 45, set in a stunning location close to all local amenities. You can enjoy a stress-free move with up to 100% part exchange on your existing property with free site fees for your first year. Make that lifestyle change today and join us at our open weekend on the 25th and 26th of April at Castleview Court, Pevensey Bay, Pevensey. Or visit ecosgroup.co.uk. That's ecosgroup.co.uk.
With an Amex business card, Selena's earning points renovating her skin clinic and refreshing the builders.
14 coffees and 28 sugars, please.
And on new adjustable chairs for every room. And she can use the points to lie back and relax.
Don't put ice cream on your brother's head.
Well, sometimes. And that's because with an Amex business card, your points can go towards holidays and more.
Search Amex business card. Interest fees and terms apply. Available to UK limited companies and limited liability partnerships. Signatories must be a director or member of the business. Subject to approval.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas, and Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
It's 18 minutes after 11. Hey, I could have got it completely wrong. Maybe you don't think that the news today that a half of young Britons would refuse to fight for their country is in any way linked to the recurring story of almost a million young people not currently being in education, employment or training. But I'm open to persuasion that I'm wrong to tie these two stories together, but I can't currently untie them. 50% say they wouldn't fight for the country under any circumstances. And as one of the people from the University of Glasgow that conducted this research said, they will say to you, why fight for a country that isn't fighting for you? Locked out of the housing market, pinned down by low wages, loaded by student debt, increasingly worried about the rise in AI. Young people today feel a growing sense of unfairness about the world around them. They're describing the status quo. And the invitation is to go and risk your life to defend the status quo. You're going to struggle, aren't you, to tell them why they should ignore that inner voice and pick up a musket. Jennifer is in Chiswick. Jennifer, what would you like to say?
Morning, James.
Hello.
So I am one of the people in that cohort who would not want to fight for the country.
It's not a question of wanting to. I don't know that any of us would want to. It's that you would categorically refuse to in any circumstances.
Well, yes, I refuse to. Mm. For context, I'm 22 years old. I still live at home, which isn't rare for somebody living in London of my age.
Of course.
And from my position, I'm actually in a privileged position. I have a job. I've saved up significant amounts. I could afford a deposit on a place, but I wouldn't be willing to do that just because it's so much money for so little value.
And you'd have so little left to live on at the end of every
exactly.
month. If that's what they're,
exactly.
I missed that out of the equation as well. Even people who've got the deposit but can't see the point in buying a property.
Yeah, mortgage rates, I think, are close to 5% now. It's pretty rough.
Well, they were in double figures when I was your age. Well, not your age, when I was a few years younger than you. So, I mean, some of these things are cyclical, but, of course, wages were much higher then as well. Because you realise there's going to be people listening to this who can't pick a hole in what you're saying, but who feel in their bones that this is traitorous talk, this is treacherous talk, there's an enemy at the gate. But that question of why fight for a country that isn't fighting for you is one that I don't think they could answer any more than you could.
I think the issue is, obviously, a lot of political discussion is around triple lock pensions, winter fuel allowance, which obviously is important, but I do think young people feel left behind.
And if Vladimir Putin, I know I said I wasn't going to do specific enemies, but if Vladimir Putin's forces were massing on the beaches of Normandy, having conquered all of continental Europe, would your mind change then, Jennifer?
Possibly in that extreme example, then maybe.
but as it stands, no. I mean, it's not there. What would you be fighting to defend? Hey, what are Ukrainians fighting for? Freedom. But, of course, your generation doesn't actually feel free in the sense that my generation did, that it had options, that it had choices, and where are the choices today? So there you go, Jennifer's put it well. You tell her why she should fight. Not why she should fight, but what she should be fighting, what she would be fighting for. 11:22 is the time. James is in Chippenham. James, what would you like to say?
Hello there, good morning. Very passionate about this. School teacher, and
yes.
So I'm dealing with children. My own tutor group are 16 years old, and they ask me these questions, and it's really difficult to argue against what they've had to experience. So
yeah.
Bear with me just 10 seconds.
Of course.
In their lifetime, 2008 crash, austerity, Brexit, Boris, COVID, Liz Truss, scandals, lack of job and career opportunity, huge student fees, rip-off repayment rates, boomers who didn't have to go out and fight, had the social and economic benefits of the EU, they now have protected pensions, they have huge house prices, which booms also benefit from, and then we ask the children who didn't have any of that to go out and fight for them to continue all of that, and ultimately that is all the children and that age group have seen and experienced. And it is outrageous now that we just say, why don't you want to go out and defend all that? They've had nothing from the system.
Oh, well, thanks a bunch. That's it, isn't it? That's it. The phone-in's over now.
Yeah.
Well, the rest, give them a round of applause. There we go.
I am so passionate about this.
And I have to obviously be professional in the workplace, but I have children, 16-year-olds, coming to me, and, you know, I feel emotional now.
I know you do.
And they say to me, I want to, you know, I'm going to join the army, or I'm thinking of joining the RAF, what do you think? And I look at them, and I say, God, what has this country ever given you so far that makes you want to go and do that? And it really gets to me.
And yet, at the same time, there's something in that ambition that is admirable, necessary.
That is worth fighting for.
Yes.
Just little feeling. Bit of hope, you know, that hope that's remaining.
Good Lord.
And above all, let me say this.
Yeah.
The people that send people to war never go to war themselves, and often their children don't either.
The United States getting an abject lesson in that particular principle at the moment from a man who dodged the draft multiple times, but has recently taken to claiming that he would have won the Vietnam War had he been president in about, I think, 27 minutes was the estimate that I most saw.
Yeah.
That was an extraordinary list of things. Where do you derive hope, or where do you derive challenge to that narrative, if indeed you do?
Do you know what? Ultimately, believe it or not, it is the children.
Yeah.
It is the children, because they are the future.
All right, Whitney.
And, yes, indeed. but they are the future, and they have the hope. But one of the reasons they have that hope is because, you know, they do struggle to project ahead, because they only see so much. But they do have that chance to do something different and to make positive choices for their lives that ultimately so many people haven't. And there are so many arguments out about at the moment, and the children are really forgotten about. And when I say children, this survey goes up, you know, young people. And you say, you know, they might go back to bed, you know, and they think this is a better offer.
Sure.
Because ultimately, what else are they being offered?
Well, that's the same question.
What if you get
nothing? The same question. Whether it is specific to the refusing to fight for your country, why would I fight for a country that doesn't fight for me? If it's just the question of needs, it's, well, what is the alternative? What would I get in return for my attention or my labour or my efforts? And we've presided over politics for generations now that has been paring away at the rewards. And as you've identified, the people who were on the right side of this historical cycle have no clue really what it's even Jays, and you may not have experience of this specifically, but I think that even people who've got children in the drop zone that you describe, who still can't quite see how different things are for them, because they're sort of thinking comforting thoughts about how we pulled our socks up, Norman bloody Tebbit, we got on our bike, we did this, we did that, why can't you? And the answers are pretty clear, but there's none so blind as those that cannot see.
And it's exactly the point you make, particularly, and I know Lewis Goodall also makes this point as well, when people say sort of like, oh, well, you know, but I had, you know, a difficult time and I had to pay for a house. You did not have to pay so much. You did not pay 5, 6, 7 times your salary to buy your house. And then you say that the people don't deserve a leg up to get theirs.
And you didn't even mention the climate. I don't think you even mentioned the climate, did you?
No.
The climate crisis
and that is
weighs
actually,
heavily on their
you know,
minds
and with
as
the
well.
Rise of the Green Party, with the rise of the Green Party, you know, this is important for the younger generations as well. Because the climate argument goes back to the 60s and the 70s as well.
Yes.
What are we leaving them? We are leaving them a mess, because the people that make decisions now will not be here when the chickens come home to roost.
Wow.
And that's the issue.
I bet you're a brilliant teacher, James.
Oh. Thank you. That is kind.
I really do.
I try.
Well, you clearly do try, and that is probably half of the battle, frankly, when it comes to being inspiring to young people. And also, you care so deeply about them. Absolutely brilliant call, writes Adam. It's made me emotional just listening to him. It's all gone a bit Dead Poet Society in the studio, hasn't it? 11:27 is the time. Look up Don Perlman, all right? This is something I should be hitting you over the head with on a regular basis. Ed Miliband came out yesterday saying we're doubling down on net zero. Because, listen, have a look at the world and what happens to countries that are reliant upon fossil fuels. I don't care where they come from, but just have a look at what happens, because there's not a planet, there's not a universe in which the North Sea is going to miraculously provide or cater to all our energy needs for the foreseeable future. But guess what? There are energy sources that are going to eventually cater for all, if we're still around, all our energy needs for the foreseeable future and indeed the unforeseeable future. And those energy sources are sustainable. So Ed Miliband comes out and says something that is so utterly uncontroversial that, frankly, you should barely have noticed. And yet in this crazy country that we've allowed to be created around us, largely for the reasons and by the people that James has just critiqued, net zero is becoming the new Brexit. No, none of these clowns can tell you why, unless they just lie through their teeth and deny the existence of anthropocentric climate change or man-made climate change, or in which case I'd invite them to go and wrap their lips around the exhaust pipe of a diesel car and then come back and tell me that, well, actually, I think you'll find the Thames used to freeze over in the 19th century. Of course we are poisoning the planet with what we do, and of course safety lies in the direction of non-polluting energy sources. And Ed Miliband is on a one-man mission, it sometimes feels. And if you want to understand the pushback on this, just Google these two words. Don, D-O-N, Pearl Man. Pearl as in clutching, as in necklaces, and man as in human. Don Pearl Man. Two words. Don Pearlman. Google it. Look him up. Find out who he was, what he did, and then have a little look around at the consequences of that man's mission still in place today. No Tufton Street without Don Pearlman. No lobby groups calling themselves think tanks, pretending to have some sort of academic rationale behind their ludicrous propaganda, getting booked by the BBC, getting booked by LBC, getting booked everywhere, despite not being able to tell you who pays their wages, because their wages are paid by fossil fuel companies or tobacco companies or fast food companies. He almost invented this. Don Pearlman. Look it up. And then, of course, come back to the question of what you would tell these young people that they would be fighting for. Here's Lottie Morley with your headlines.
Sakir Starmer must face MPs for a second time this week over the row about Lord Mandelson's appointment. The Prime Minister says the Foreign Office withheld information from him, but yesterday senior official Sir Ollie Robbins claimed Number 10 had a dismissive approach to the peers' security checks. UK inflation has jumped to its highest level since December after a sharp rise in fuel prices. Rachel Reeves says the conflict in Iran is not our war, but is still pushing up bills for families and businesses. At least three ships have been hit by gunfire in the Strait of Hormuz. It comes after Donald Trump said he would extend the ceasefire with Iran that was supposed to end today. Military planners are heading to London to discuss how to make sure the key shipping route stays open after the conflict ends. LBC weather, dry and settled with sunny spells for most of the UK this afternoon. Some outbreaks of rain in the northeast and southwest, a high of 17 degrees.
This is LBC.
You've probably been with the same energy supplier for decades. And why wouldn't you be? Loyalty matters. But lately, bigger hasn't always felt better. You've probably dealt with long waits and endless automated menus in search of someone who can actually help. Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. Our people focus on the most important thing: you. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no, just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
So many cats love whiskers. Tabby cats. Grumpy cats. Cats who are obsessed with birds. Cats who play in cardboard boxes. Cats who like to steal your socks. And that one cat who talks back. 9 out of 10 cats love new whiskers. Trust the purr. Try the best ever whiskers.
Tesco Insurance are driving down the cost of motoring with 10% off car insurance. Take out a car insurance policy before the 15th of May 2026 and you'll get 10% off with club card prices. We offer a range of cover options so you can choose the one that's right for you. Save 10% when you buy or renew a car policy with Tesco Insurance. Search Tesco Car Insurance and get a quote direct today. Club card required. Excludes add-ons. T's and C's apply.
I'm Will Buxton.
I'm Naomi Schiff.
I'm David Caulfield.
And I'm Joni Shaw.
This is Up to Speed. Available every Monday and Thursday on Global Player or wherever you get your podcasts.
The label.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
It's 33 minutes after 11. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I mean, Jason, I love your answer, not least because it makes me homesick. But I don't think that this is necessarily going to reach many of the people that we're talking about, but I'm going to read it in its entirety. Hi, James. My son is an RAF cadet in Kiddy. Woohee! Where is that? Is that in the shrubbery, Jason? Is it the shrubbery? Because used the old TA place next door to my old school, to the convent, next door to the convent on Birmingham Road. But I don't know where the RAF cadets congregate in Kidderminster, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's there. He is in peacetime gaining friendships, discipline, flight experiences and training. I joined the RAF cadets at my school because they promised us we'd go flying in, I think, Chipmunks was the type of plane that they used. It was a lie. It was one of my first introductions to authority lying. Just trying to sign us up. I don't know whether they got paid more, the school's liaison officers or whatever it was. They said, because we all got a pitch. You had to do, I think it was on Tuesday afternoons, you had to do CCF. Looking back, I'm surprised I didn't plead conscientious objection just to sort of cause trouble, which was my modus operandi during my school days. But I signed with the RAF. The Navy made some good. The Navy actually went on ships. They had like a trip to a ship. And the Army got to fire guns quite a lot. RAF, they told us we would go on planes, we would go on chipmunks, and it never happened. In fact, I remember Wing Commander, I can remember his name, but I don't think it would be fair to say it out loud. The Wing Commander that would come in to educate us as RAF cadets, I remember him saying, Cadet O'Brien, you are the worst cadet it is my misfortune to have encountered in 30 years as school's liaison officer. And I said, but you told us we were going to go flying, Wing Commander. You told us we would go on planes. And all the lads sort of go, yeah, you did. You never went on a plane. So Jason's boy's already doing better than me as an RAF cadet. He's got flight experiences, training, engineering, electronic skills, teamwork. We chose the Air Force based on two factors. It's statistically the safest of the forces, and he loves aviation. And then you go on, I'd like him to go to a commercial flight school or do an engineering degree when he grows up, rather than go into active service. That being said, service does offer rewards and skills that can be life-changing rather than life-ending. So, oddly, there's two questions, isn't there? I mean, going into the military, and James in Chippenham touched on this, can be a very attractive or a very good option for some young people, but oddly, and Jason unwittingly makes this point, that doesn't necessarily mean that you'd want to go to war, or indeed that you would want your child to go to war. But if half of under 30s are saying they wouldn't fight for this country under any circumstances, if you're troubled by that statistic, you need to tell them what they would be fighting for. 11:36 is the time. Stu's in Western Supermare. Stu, what do you reckon?
Good morning, James.
Hello, Stu.
Hello. Yeah, 49-year-old father of three. I have a 26-year-old son who have absolutely no interest in politics. That will probably be. I am very political.
Okay.
He and they've been brought up in that sort of environment.
But however, it hasn't stuck.
I think they're all left of centre, but they have no real political identity, which is fine.
Well, partly because of what we're talking about, I imagine. They can't see... Right, sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted you. Go on.
No, that's fine. I mean, he has no interest in buying a property. He bought a Luton van, has converted that. He lives in that, and he's a tree surgeon.
Okay.
He works, then he goes travelling around the world. He has... And this leads me on when I speak about my two daughters.
Yes.
He has no real identity or affinity to this country.
Gosh.
Which I understand.
Yeah.
My 17-year-old daughter is at college, struggling terribly at the moment with all sorts of sort of mental health issues.
I'm sorry.
It's tough.
It's tough for you as well. I know you won't be comfortable with me saying that, but I know that it's tough for you as well, and you need to acknowledge that.
It really is, but I also think she represents a massive swathe
for sure
of people of her age who will be sitting in their room on their phones.
Yeah,
and that
making some of the issues worse.
Yes, I've no doubt on that. Yeah. And again, that sort of leads me, James, into, again, she's lost at the moment. You know, I'm very confident that will turn round in time. But she has no affinity. She has no...
What would she be fighting for?
And this is the thing. They look at it and think, well, what would I be fighting for?
Do you say? Or can you say something? Can you say?
Well, I would say, you know, it was much easier previous generations. I think you touched on it, the good versus evil. You know, and I'm by no means a military man, quite the opposite. However, I always thought, if, for example, Putin invaded, you know, in the way he did in Ukraine, if I was of an age, I would probably sign up because I would see that as a good versus equal. I would do that. I had no way I could see my son or eldest daughter doing that.
And so you'd be simultaneously understanding and... what's the other word, Stu? Because it's not disappointed, is it? Because that involves a portion of blame or negativity. So you'd rather they lived in a world where they didn't feel like this. And how does that make you feel?
It's a rabbit hole I would like to get out of.
Yes.
I would like us all to get out of that rabbit hole, because I do...
Well, the other alternative is to ignore it or to pretend it's not there, to not look up and just shout things like, get on your bike, or in my day, or they're lazy, or it's cosseting, or it's your fault. It's your fault as a parent that they're not like... I mean, which is just in ignorance of the facts, but we've lived in an era... Yeah, it's just where we live now.
Completely farcical point of view. I would suggest completely escapes of reality for these kids and what they're going through and what they've been through. And what they will go through.
And we're not. I mean, James in Chippenham, the teacher, was so powerful, wasn't he? And he didn't he didn't mention climate change, and he didn't mention social media. So even with his litany of troubles, the two arguably of the very biggest weren't even on his particular page, because he's talking about the young people that he's working with every day. And we never really acknowledge any of this. And this must be, so it doesn't necessarily describe any of your kids directly, but had they chosen to not be in education, employment or training, it would be largely for the same sort of reasons that you're describing. For some of the year, your boy isn't, of course. If he's off travelling, he's not off grid, but he is off the conveyor belt.
Very much so, and has zero interest in joining that conveyor belt. Where I think, you know, like I said, I'm 49. In my working experience, it was all about getting on that conveyor belt,
and because you could see where it went. Even, you know, I don't want to turn into Ray Davis, but even if it did lead to a sort of regimented existence, it was still quite pleasant. I've got my own home, I've got my own car, I've got my own hair. All right, I'm getting a bit carried away now, but you can't. That idea of an Englishman's home being his castle, it's a cliche for a reason, and yet he can be perfectly capable of earning a living, but not seeing the living being worth the work 24/7, or rather, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week for the rest of his natural. And this is missing. Earlier caller mentioned Lewis Goodall's brilliant on this subject. He's quite a bit younger than me, so he's a lot closer to the action than I am. But it is absolutely crucial. And politically, I glance to my left, and Nigel flipping Farage is on my telly again. And the idea that he is going to be of any use whatsoever to these people or to this picture that we paint, he's one of the biggest architects of it. He's one of the people most responsible for it. But we don't talk about them. We talk about triple locks. We talk about, pensions, and we talk about winter fuel allowances correctly, I suppose. But we never talk about this. And that's why the problem isn't going away. Thank you, Stu. MJ is in Edinburgh. MJ, what would you like to say?
I like to say I completely agree with the teacher you had on earlier.
Really?
But one point that I think is being missed, I'm a 25-year-old myself.
Yeah.
One point that I think is being missed is we've grown up with, the internet and a bit later on. So we're seeing all of these people who we would be fighting against. It's unlike the days of, World War II, I would say, is a completely justified war. But pretty much every war since then, you look at and go,
who was fighting for what? what were we fighting for? And also, we're seeing the people we would be fighting against online. We feel more kinship to the world, I think, than even our parents did.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that.
Because we've grown up in a more globalized world. So why are we fighting for these people who are, like...
Why are we killing these people?
When arguably we share a lot more in common with people in our own situation abroad.
That's extraordinary. And I wonder if it's relevant to something that I nearly talked about today, but I preferred this story in the moment when I made the decision, which is two things that have happened recently. One is that many people in the United States and beyond who call themselves Christians have expressed way more outrage at Donald Trump styling himself as Jesus or insulting the Pope than they did when ICE agents were shooting people in the face in Minneapolis or deporting and rounding up entirely innocent people. As if the imagery was somehow more important than the humanity. And similarly, in Lebanon, the IDF soldiers who filmed themselves attacking a crucifix with an axe, I think, have caused more outrage and more apparent remorse on the part of Benjamin Netanyahu than killing 75,000 Palestinians. And I wonder whether that's a generational thing and that your generation would find that absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I was thinking about this in the shower this morning.
Excellent.
And it made me so angry.
Yeah.
Because I was raised Christian, like Church of England. I probably wouldn't consider myself like a practicing Christian anymore, but I grew up with a lot of those values. And I look at that and go, if Jesus were here, what would he care about? A statue or a crucifix of him being defaced or all of the innocent people that are just being killed to settle an ideological difference? Like, that situation is very complicated. I have a lot of sympathy for the people of Palestine, but for anyone that is being killed for no reason, like, what is the world come to? What are we doing where we care more about an image of a God that said, no, we shouldn't worship false idols than the actual people?
How dare you bring the Ten Commandments into your critique of Christianity? This is absolutely outrageous. You should be quoting Pulp Fiction in the current context. What a lovely call. Thank you.
It just feels like the world's gone backwards.
Well, it has. It has. And of course, the thing that you're describing, or the thing that we're all trying to describe in words, that feeling, that sense, is the one represented by the clowns climbing up lampposts to stick flags up outside houses whose residents don't want them. They think that's somehow patriotic, whereas what it really is a sort of... It's the equivalent of dogs weeing in the street in order to tell other dogs that they've been here or that they have that it's their territory or whatever it is. Everybody knows that. It's just that we're such a backwards country at the moment that people are pretending not to understand it. 11:46 is the time.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Fuel prices up by more than 30%. Heating oil bills trebled. Meanwhile, supermarket costs soar and shortages are threatened. What can be done about this up and away in our cost of living?
Not against profit, but against profiteering. I was proposing a whole range of different ideas, and one of them was essentially a temporary crisis-driven, time-limited margin cap.
Your chance to put your questions to him, Iceland boss and the government's cost of living champion, Richard Walker, as he takes your calls in another LBC exclusive phone-in.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Time to bring your out-of-date kitchen up to date. Wix has over 80 kitchen styles so you can find the perfect one. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. Or wobbly, or wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxed.
Georgie's up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby. Download the Thames Link Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story.
Search Kayak for great deals on Wait, that doesn't say flights. Search Kayak for great deals on car hire? Huh. With Kayak, you can compare hundreds of car rental sites to find great deals. Even better, you see costs up front. And if it's flexibility you're after, Kayak's got a handy free cancellation filter. Lovely stuff. So next time you're searching for car hire, at home or for your holes, search Kayak. and go see for yourself.
What's the best present you ever got for your birthday? I bet it wasn't as life-changing as £1 million. Every week with the birthday draw, there's £1 million to be won. And you can enter from as little as £1, or via post. Enter by midnight on Sunday, and your special day could win you £1 million. Visit thebirthdaydraw.com. Is it your lucky day? From Global and ITV. 18 plus, UK only, no purchase necessary.
Feel like getting back under your duvet in the middle of the day? Ferroglobin is a great tasting liquid formula with iron, which contributes to the reduction of tiredness and fatigue and normal formation of hemoglobin. Ferroglobin from Vitabiotics at Boots, pharmacies and vitabiotics.com.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It is 11:49, without troubling Idiot's Corner. Half a dozen texts coming in, talking about how it's all the fault of immigrants, which is, you know, that's the land that Nigel built. So, by coincidence, actually, I've got a guest coming in after PMQs from Inside Housing magazine. I said to you a while ago, as our media circled ever more violently the plug hole of irrelevance and misinformation, that the trade press is where you get the stories. The trade press is where you get the truths, because they can't indulge in propaganda or client journalism. They just have to deal with the facts as they discover them. And Inside Housing have been looking at the scale of anti-immigrant views and misinformation in the housing world and the toll that these racist lies take on both staff and tenants. It's an extraordinary report, the author of which will be joining us at about 10 to 1 today. Simon March joining us shortly after 12:30 for the latest from the United States of America. I posted something on Blue Sky the other day about, does anyone know yet whether it's a ceasefire day or we're going to obliterate your civilization day? And of course, many people replied both, James. So today is an extend the ceasefire day. I don't know whether you're aware of this. This is the ceasefire in the war that was only going to take 6 weeks and that he said a month ago would be over in two. Is that about right? Does that cover things? Strait of Hormuz, ships being hit. The question of why we can't all just go back to where we were before is yet to be answered. But on we go. Lies about nuclear capabilities, of course. Benjamin Netanyahu insisting since the 1970s that Iran was 7 seconds away from building a nuclear bomb. Donald Trump reduced latterly to joining in that nonsense just 6 months after claiming that he'd obliterated any capabilities of doing so anyway, and completely ignoring the fact that the deal that was put in place under Barack Obama is now, I'm afraid, out of reach. Best case scenario for a while, just pretend it never happened. Best case scenario for an even shorter while, get some sort of deal in place that looks a lot like Barack Obama's deal, but nobody dares say that in front of Donald Trump. That ship seems to have sailed now as well. Everything will be worse. 11:51 is the time. But I don't know that that is a particularly contributing factor to the question that we're asking this hour, which is, what would you say to a young person who said that they wouldn't fight for their country? Imagine watching your son go off to fight for Donald Trump in Iran, or your daughter, and having to ask yourself, what are they actually going to fight for? So that Donald Trump's mates can make money on the markets by placing enormous bets shortly before he makes his latest announcement? Is that a topic we could do tomorrow? What do they think they're fighting for? American troops being sent to Iran? Oh, it might be too bleak, actually. But it kind of plays into the conversation we're having about the half of young Britons who would refuse to fight for this country. Morgan is in Andover in Hampshire. Morgan, what would you like to say?
Hi, James.
Hello.
I think my wider point is less about perhaps the specifics of your conversation, but more about the youth voice in this country as a whole.
Yes.
I'm a young person, I'm 18, and I can't help but feel like young people can talk to young people about their views. Everyone loves to talk about young people's views and opinions, but there's no connection between the two. And almost we need young people to tell others what they think and give them a voice so that they can sort of communicate perhaps more effectively and perhaps come to better conclusions about broader topics. Mm. Maybe we would have something to fight for if...
This isn't a new
communication between the two.
Yeah, it's a brilliant point. It's not a new thing, but the situation in which young people find themselves is new.
Yes.
So we need a new model of discourse to recognize. Well, I mean, to be fair, I'm doing my best, Morgan, but I'm just one radio show and one radio station, and hearing from people in precisely the catchment area that we're talking about. What do you think are the biggest things that my generation simply don't get?
Well, I think it's often just the question asked. I think the we often lump all young people in so, like, in one lump, whereas I'm very different from perhaps a 24-year-old. I'm very different from my 19-year-old brother, just from our COVID experience, from our school experience.
Yes.
Those things have all changed so rapidly, and we just can't seem to keep up with that as an idea. I seem to think maybe that we should have, like, I don't know, maybe a rotating youth, almost in my mind, I picture it like we could have a youth panel for a big newspaper of some kind. It would have to be print media, not social media.
Sure. Why? Why would it have, to reach the older generation as opposed to...
To reach the older generation, to reach the people who aren't talking to young people on a daily, not just parents and teachers and people in public services, but everybody who... should have an understanding of the other people they occupy the world with.
Yes. You just get dismissed. You just get people writing columns in the Daily Mail about how you don't really have concerns, or you don't really have, I'm not speaking about you directly now, making up neurodiversity, or we didn't have depression in my day, or they're just, I don't know what they're, it's just you're always being told what you're doing and what you're thinking. You're never being asked.
Exactly.
Gosh. That's pretty grim, actually. What about one danger of a sort of false homogeneity, if that's even a word? The idea that someone like me, and I have daughters your age or thereabouts, and I know that, for example, they're 2 years apart, like you and your brother are 1 year apart, and I can't, there's not a lot I can say that would hold equally true for both of them. So, we talk about young people. It's a fairly unhelpful categorisation, but it's the only one we've got. What would they almost all have in common? Answer, well, you tell me.
Oh, well, I think maybe that's a tricky question.
It is,
perhaps,
isn't it?
Is that misunderstanding and feeling misunderstood or misrepresented by the media is the link more than anything?
Yeah.
I think that was actually my answer.
No, there's a line that I think it was an Estonian caller talked about when we first started discussing the war in Ukraine, and they were talking about the post-war settlement, the post-Second World War settlement, and that phrase that really stuck with me was that all of the negotiations, all of the conversations were about us but without us.
Yeah.
And that's what you're describing to me about your generation in this country, about us but without us. Slovakian, I think she was. Slovakian. Okay. But anyway, thank you. And listen, you're always welcome here. It's not a lot, but it's better than nothing, Morgan.
thank you very much.
You're very welcome. 11:56 is the time. PMQ's imminent. Listen, whatever your politics are. What were those four tribes we identified at the top of the show this morning? It is a very interesting political moment. More interesting for people like Natasha Clark and indeed myself than it is for people who are struggling to put food on the table or wondering about how they're going to get through the day. But if you are interested in the daily to-ing and fro-ing of politics, then you cannot but be interested in the situation that Keir Starmer currently finds himself in. In fact, the size of the open goal that Kemi Badenoch will find herself limbering up in front of in a few minutes' time cannot be exaggerated, cannot be overstated. And indeed, Natasha Clark, our political editor, is here. I mean, six questions all on the same thing today. Do you think?
Maybe she'll ask the same six questions that she asked Keir Starmer a couple of days ago about Lord Wellington. She said that she had taken an unprecedented step in giving them to him beforehand in an attempt to try and get an answer out of him. And I think it is fair to say that he has, in PMQs in the past, hasn't he, struggled to answer some of these questions and tried to dodge and deflect. But equally, he spent Monday, answering 2.5 hours of MPs' questions.
Yeah, that's true.
And trying his best to sort of, you know, do what he could to try and draw a line under this whole sorry saga and move on, you know. And as some of your callers have been saying this morning, he's apologised for this and appointing Mandelson time and time and time and time again. What more can he do? What more does Kemi Badenoch not want to hear?
Might she call for Ollie Robbins to be reinstated or something a little bit unexpected like that?
Yes, Lord Sedwell has written in the Times today, hasn't he, saying that he believes that he's unfairly dismissed. And actually, I think that will probably be part of an ongoing HR case, at least according to that letter that Ollie Robbins sent to the committee yesterday, which said, you know, this is all to do with my HR contract and I can't really get into this at the moment. So I imagine he will be pushing to see if there is a case there for unfair dismissal. I don't think we've seen the end of that, but I don't think Keir Starmer is going to turn around and U-turn on that one, is he, and reinstate this guy. It's really difficult once you lose the trust of the Prime Minister that you're serving to sort of make the case for your sort of reassessment, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, you know that I don't think wobbled is quite the right word. I've veered quite violently from position to position on this. And
I think we all have.
Well, quite rightly, yeah. Because the facts keep changing.
I mean, so then you change your mind.
It turned out that the vetting hadn't been failed in the sense that we all thought it had been failed on Friday, but it had been sort of failed in a slightly different sense. So, you know, it's been almost impossible to hold the same line throughout and dangerous to try to do so. Which brings us back to Kemi Badenoch, who doesn't really do nuance.
No, and she also, I don't know if she's going to sort of do what she did in the Commons yesterday, which I did think was quite good yesterday. Yeah. She was quite forensic in just setting out the arguments from Ollie Robbins and what he said, and just getting the reaction from the Prime Minister on the things that he said. And there are still a few, of course, there are still major unanswered questions. I think the Prime Minister, what she will want to push him on is, why did you decide that this guy was going to be the fall guy for this whole saga? And as you were talking about, is this really to do with Jeffrey Epstein or not? You know, will she decide to push him on the nuance that is between his business links to other places and other people, which we believe
that's
is the reason he failed that security vetting? Or will she continue to push Epstein because that's the more sort of politically convenient excuse
and
that she can use?
The reason why Ollie Robbins got the boot in the first place, in that it is a sort of emotional response to a situation rather than a process or fact-based one, which is what everybody who voted for Keir Starmer thought that they were voting for.
Exactly.
I mean, it's an almighty mess. And would you agree that the Ollie Robbins story is now a bigger problem for the Prime Minister than the Peter Mandelson, or at least the vetting story?
I think so, because I think it's going to cause him lots of problems later down the line, right? If your civil service aren't on your side, you're going to find it very difficult to deliver the policies that you want to do. And one of the biggest concerns and the biggest criticisms of Keir Starmer so far, and you actually heard this from Angela Rayner last night, she was giving a speech to the Good Growth Foundation, and she was talking about how she feels that this Labour government needs to be much bigger and bolder in their ideas and their policies. If you don't have the civil service on side, if they can't trust you, how are you going to push through this big, bold, radical agenda that people think you want? And that's going to, I think, really come back to bite him, especially as a man that's made so much of his political career on being
a great point.
That's that guy that you can trust, right?
That's a great point. And Dave Penman, the head of the FDA, the sort of trade union for civil servants, has made, I think it was on with Sheila yesterday, making no bones about how unimpressed he is by events recently. We're at that point in the programme where I remind you that we will cross live to the House of Commons imminently when Kemi Badenoch gets to her feet and starts putting her questions to the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer. So, I mean, what are the odds on PMQs this week not standing for Prime Minister's questions but standing instead for Peter Mandelson questions?
Oh, yeah, very good. Nice. Thank you. Yeah. Whenever I write my notes, I write PM for Peter Mandelson. Yeah. But then sometimes I get confused because it also stands for Prime Minister.
Confusing. But it's unlikely that she'll mention inflation or mention...
Look, potentially. If the government obviously...
Sorry to talk over you. I'll just get my own thought out before you respond. Inflation and the rest of it, almost all... give Starmer the opportunity to mention
talk
the war.
About the war, yeah. Exactly, yeah. But equally, he's desperate to talk about it. She might be, you know, of the opinion that that I think a lot of people are, that we need to stop talking about Peter Mandelson now and sort of draw a line under this story and now sort of look to other areas around the world. So, and that is Iran, the cost of living crisis, all the other things the government have got on their plate. So potentially both leaders may, and I say may, decide to move on and talk about inflation, cost of living. You know, if I were the Prime Minister, what would you do as a sort of dead cat scenario here? I would come forward with my Iran cost of living plan right now to try and give someone else and the media and everybody else a bit of something else to talk about.
But there's blood in the water.
Mm. So for Kemi Badenoch, exactly, it feels like this is the opportunity to push him again on Peter Mandelson.
Too young, I think, to... Did you ever read Viz magazine?
Viz?
No. There was a strip in Viz magazine called The Pathetic Sharks, and I don't know why when I just...
Think of Kemi Badenoch as a pathetic shark.
I just thought of Kemi Badenoch when I mentioned that there was blood in the water. I thought of the pathetic sharks in Viz magazine, which is a little cultural nod for probably, 15% of the listenership to this programme? Or maybe a little more, I don't know.
Arguably, she has done well on Mandelson.
She's done very well. I don't think it's arguable.
Exactly. So she might just be thinking it's time to capitalise on that politically again.
Maybe.
With what's been happening.
But she does have a terrible habit of snatching embarrassment from the jaws of success.
Oh, very good. Very good. Yeah, but she will obviously make this again about her and, I called for Peter Mandelson to resign, I've repeatedly said this, but it does feel a bit like Groundhog Day, doesn't it? We're having the same conversations again and again, and, you know, where do we draw the line under this Peter Mandelson debacle? When is it going to stop? When is it going to end?
And speaking of Groundhog Day, I still can't get past the insight that popped up during our conversations, either on Friday or on Monday, that hang on, I may not hear it ever again, because the MQs is with us.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Prime Minister stand by his statement at the dispatch box on the 10th of September last year, that full due process was followed in the appointment of Peter Mandelson as our ambassador to Washington?
Yes, I do. Mr. Speaker, let me make clear at the outset that the appointment itself was a mistake. It was my mistake. I've apologised to the victims for it, and I do so again. What I set out to the House on Monday is that Foreign Office officials granted security clearance to Mandelson against the recommendation of UK security vetting. Yesterday, Sir Ollie Robbins was asked if he shared that decision with me, Number 10, or any other ministers. He gave a clear answer, no. Mr. Speaker, that puts to bed all the allegations levelled at me by those opposite in relation to dishonesty. Last week they were all saying that it must have been shared with me. Sir Ollie was very clear yesterday it was not. I believe not sharing it was a serious error of judgment. That information should have been shared with me and other ministers. And if it had have been, Mandelson would not have been committed to post.
Mr. Speaker, it does not put to bed anything. On the 11th of November 2024, long before any vetting had happened, the Prime Minister received advice from Simon Case, the then Cabinet Secretary. The advice said the appointment would require, and I quote, the necessary security clearances before confirming the Prime Minister's choice. This advice was ignored. So how can the Prime Minister still believe that confirming Mandelson before the security clearances was following full due process?
Mr. Speaker, this was looked into by Sir Chris Wormald. I asked him to review the appointment process, including the vetting. He confirmed, Mr. Speaker, his words, appropriate processes were followed. She's put great weight on the order of events. I remind her what Sir Chris said last November in evidence to the House. He said this, and I quote, when we are making appointments from outside the civil service, the normal thing is for security clearance to happen after appointment, but before the person signs a contract and takes up post. That is what happened in this case. Sir Ollie Robbins himself, Mr. Speaker, also gave evidence, and he said, and I quote, as is normally the case with external appointments in his department, the appointment was made subject to obtaining security clearance. Mr. Speaker, on top of that, Sir Ollie Robbins has made clear that the fact that developed vetting was after announcement made, in his words, no material difference to the conclusion that was reached. And Mr. Speaker, I add this, that what Sir Ollie Robbins wrote to the committee yesterday was this, and I quote, when the Prime Minister informed the House that the proper process had been followed in respect of national security vetting, he was correct.
It's very interesting that he mentions Chris Warmald. He is relying on advice given to him after Mandelson was sacked by a cabinet secretary the prime minister then sacked. That is not relevant. I'm talking about the advice he was given before the appointment. He keeps mentioning Sir Ollie Robbins. Sir Ollie Robbins told us that the prime minister even sought clearance from His Majesty the King before the vetting. He'd already got agreement from the US administration. The chair of the select committee said that. Mandelson was a done deal. Yesterday, Sir Ollie Robbins said that the focus was on getting Mandelson out to Washington quickly. He said the Prime Minister's team showed a dismissive attitude to vetting. And they even argued Peter Mandelson didn't need any vetting at all. This clearly wasn't proper process. Why was due process not followed?
Mr. Speaker, let me deal with this directly, particularly this question of pressure in relation to the decision to appoint and to put into post Peter Mandelson. So Ollie Robbins could not have been clearer in his evidence yesterday. He said this, I didn't feel under pressure personally in terms of my judgment. His words. Mr. Speaker, he went on to say, I have complete confidence that recommendations to me and the discussions we had and the decision we made were rigorously independent of any pressure. Mr. Speaker, on top of that, he was asked if any conversations led him to believe that Mandelson needed to take up the role regardless of vetting outcome. He said, I can say with certainty it was never put to me in that way. No pressure existed whatsoever in relation to this case. What is unacceptable is that the recommendation of UKSV was not given to me before Mandelson took up his post.
Mr. Speaker, we all heard what Sir Ollie Robbins said yesterday. The fact of the matter is that the Prime Minister spent a lot of time telling us just how furious he was to learn that Mandelson failed the vetting, the same Prime Minister who was trying to get into Washington without any vetting at all, which is unbelievable. The reason the Cabinet Secretary advised the Prime Minister to carry out full vetting before the appointment, this is common sense, Mr. Speaker, carry out full vetting before the appointment was to protect our national security. The due diligence document said Mandelson remained on the board of the Kremlin-linked defence company Systema long after Putin's first invasion of Ukraine in 2014. The Prime Minister told us on Monday that he'd read that due diligence report. Why did the Prime Minister want to make a man with links to the Kremlin our ambassador in Washington?
Well, Mr. Speaker, let me deal with the first allegation she put in that question. It was always the case that would be developed vetting in this case. That was the understood process that was carried out. It was reviewed by Sir Chris Warmold, and he said it was the appropriate process. Sir Ollie was absolutely clear that nobody put pressure on him to make this appointment, either whatever the sequence, developed a vetting. In relation to what was in the due process, any issues of national security are dealt with in the developed vetting process. I knew that. Peter Mandelson received clearance through that process. The problem was, as I said to the House, I was unaware that UKSV recommended against clearance. That is information that should have been brought to my attention. Mr. Speaker, they recommended with red flags that there shouldn't be clearance, and it was high concern. That information should have been made available to me at the time and subsequently. The fact that it wasn't was a very serious error of judgment.
I don't know what planet the Prime Minister is on, Mr. Speaker. Appointing someone with known links to the Kremlin is not full due process. anybody had brought that sort of name to me when I was a Secretary of State, I would have said, no way. Absolutely. The Prime Minister thought someone with Kremlin links was still probably okay. Let's do some vetting. Why does this matter? He keeps leaning on Sir Ollie Robbins, a man he sacked. He keeps leaning on him. Sir Ollie Robbins said yesterday that Peter Mandelson was given access to highly classified briefings even before he'd received clearance. That was a clear national security risk. How can the Prime Minister still maintain that full due process was followed?
Mr. Speaker, as a member of the House of Lords and Privy Councillor, and in accordance with guidance, documentation could have been provided to him and was provided to him. Strap material comes after developed vetting. But because he was a Privy Councillor, he could have access to other material before developed vetting.
This is a joke. He says a member of the House of Lords. Does he mean people like Matthew Doyle? Yeah. I'm amazed. Yes. I am amazed at the level of chuntering from Labour MPs. He promised them probity. What he's given them is cronyism and an old boys' club where Matthew Doyle is being proposed as an ambassador. It's ridiculous. Mr. Speaker, we all heard Sir Ollie Robbins' testimony yesterday. The head of the Foreign Office was sacked for the Prime Minister's own failings. His backbenchers know that is not fair. Even his most loyal cabinet members won't defend it. The Prime Minister did not follow the process the Cabinet Secretary set out in November 2024. He knows he did not follow due process, yet he told the House he had. Mr. Speaker, I cannot accuse the Prime Minister of deliberately misleading the House, but everyone can see what has happened here. This was not due process. Everyone knows the price of misleading the House. Will the Prime Minister finally take responsibility and go?
Mr. Speaker, let's be absolutely clear. Before Mandelson took up his post, UKSB recommended with red flags that clearance should be denied, and there was high concern. That was not brought to my attention or the attention of the Foreign Secretary at the time or subsequently is a very serious error of judgment. And anyone in my position would have lost confidence in the former Permanent Secretary. But, Mr. Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition claimed on Friday that Mandelson could not have been cleared against security advice. She was wrong about that. She said that ministers must have been told. She was wrong about that. She claimed there was deliberate dishonesty. She was wrong about that. Wrong, wrong, wrong. She rushed to judgment as she always did, just like the Iran war. Mr. Speaker, I was elected by the British people because they let the country down for 14 long years. Whatever she says, whatever noise they make, nothing is going to distract me from delivering for our country.
In contrast to the preoccupations of the Leader of the Opposition, my constituents are more concerned with the NHS and waiting lists. Thanks to this government, across England, waiting lists are coming down. In my part of the country, waiting lists have fallen by 13,000 in the past year alone. Yeah. After years of Tory failure, we're getting the NHS back on its feet. Yeah. Can the Prime Minister share with me what further plans we've got to get waiting lists down even more and to make sure that we've once again got a health service to be proud of?
Yeah. Well, the party opposite should hang their heads in shame at the state they left our NHS in. That this Labour government is fixing our NHS across the country. Waiting lists, Mr. Speaker, the lowest for 3 years. Best A&E waiting times for 5 years. Fastest ambulance respond times for half a decade. Cancer patients getting diagnosed in the shortest time on record. Lots done, more to do. That's why we're delivering neighbourhood health centres in every community to speed up care. We did that because we invested. What did they do? They broke the NHS and then they opposed the investment that we put in.
David, Leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Mr. Speaker, can I associate myself, my party, with the comments of the Prime Minister on our wonderful late Queen?
And can I also agree with him on the need to confront anti-Semitism wherever it is in our society, and also remembering Stephen Lawrence and his family? Mr. Speaker, I'm sure many of us in this House were shocked by the new revelations from Ollie Robbins yesterday. He said Number 10 told him to find a plum job for Matthew Doyle, another Labour crony friends with a convicted sex offender. Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister was asked on Monday whether Number 10 had proposed any political appointments other than Mandelson. Perhaps the last few hours have jogged his memory. Will he confirm today, did he know his office was lobbying for a diplomatic job for Matthew Doyle? And were they doing it on his authority?
Mr. Speaker, as I said earlier, Matthew Doyle worked for many years in public service for me as Prime Minister and other ministers. When people leave roles in any organisation, there are very often conversations about other roles they may want to apply for. In this case, nothing came of it.
Sir Ed Davey.
Mr. Speaker, the House and the public watching will note the Prime Minister failed to answer my questions. But Mr. Speaker, the chaos in this government mustn't stop us from focusing on the cost of living crisis hitting our country. President Trump's idiotic war with Iran has already pushed up inflation in our country to 3.3%. And the Prime Minister knows there's far worse to come for the British people here on in. They need help now. So will the Prime Minister follow other countries and use the Treasury's extra revenues from higher fuel prices to cut rail and bus fares and slash prices at the pump by 12p a litre?
Mr. Speaker, everybody can see that the conflict is causing serious economic damage in this country and countries around the world. His claim of a windfall for the government are politically misleading and economically illiterate.
Thank you,
Mr. Speaker.
And we're back in the room. Well, I don't know where to start, but I'd have to decide after this.
This is LBC.
Oh, you want weight loss advice?
Weight loss? Actually, what you want to do...
I got my weight loss secret from my mother, who got it from her mother's
weight loss?
I know, forget that.
You just have keep dancing.
Dragon fruit.
Podcast.
Advice.
Or you could go to MedExpress. MedExpress. Healthcare without the noise. Go to medexpress.co.uk/weightloss.
Ali 60 milligram hard capsules contain orlistat for overweight adults with a BMI of 28 plus. Follow a reduced calorie, low fat diet. Always read the label.
Have you spotted anything?
Only seagulls. Are you sure this beach is a nature reserve?
Well, the sign said nature this way. Hey, what's that big bird over there? Flapping its wings, unusual markings.
You sure that sign didn't say nature-ists?
Oi, this is a nudist beach.
Ooh. Now, where are my binoculars?
Cheryl?
Struggling to read in the sun? Get 2-for-1 at Specsavers and make prescription sunglasses your second pair. From £70 with standard single vision lenses to the same prescription. Terms and conditions apply. See in store for details.
How does a $20 golf gadget end up being used as a bomb detector in war zones worldwide? I'm Alice Levine and this is Explosive Lies, the podcast exposing a scam that fooled governments and security services across the globe. Open our free Global Player app and search Explosive Lies to start listening today.
The following is from TFL.
I got loads of flowers the other day and messages from people I didn't even know. My mate spelled my name in tea lads and my mom hung my favourite footy shirt on the railings next to the lamppost where I got killed by a nice lady, just someone who thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall. Energising a better Britain.
21 minutes after 12 is the time. The one thing that I was not expecting that PMQs to be was boring. But somehow Kemi Badenoch rose to the challenge and delivered. We had an interesting evolution of analogy, Natasha and I, during the news bulletin, and one of us suggested that it was a score, that it was a nil-nil draw, and the other person pointed out that we had described Kemi Badenoch as facing an own goal, an open goal. So if it was a nil-nil draw, then the person that missed the open goal probably comes off the pitch in rather worse shape than the person who did not miss an open goal.
For sure. And she should be leaving the chamber going, didn't really nail him on anything, really, did I? And she didn't. There was no standout moment. What you did see is both of them rising to each other, didn't you? Mm. They both clearly hate each other, don't they? They both really dislike each other, and that was evident.
I mean, she clearly hates him.
Oh, no, I think he hates her.
You think he hates her? Yeah, he certainly had a problem with Boris Johnson. I think he finds her a bit ridiculous.
But also, you sort of saw him, in some of his responses, raising his voice in the way that she has done time and time again at PMQs, which I don't think suits her style and I don't think works. And actually, I kind of wanted to see him put a little bit more fire in his belly in his fight, but maybe this isn't the week for that. Maybe it was all about keeping the ball away from the open goal, if we will go down this analogy.
Yes.
It's all about footballification, isn't it?
There's not a lot. I mean, most weeks it's about, obviously, the nature of people who get in touch with the programme is going to be self-selecting. So a good week for Cammie Badenoch would be 50-50. So I can't see any positive analyses of how she... Oh, here's one. Oh, no, it's a joke, sorry. It's an amazing performance by Cammie. Three swings and three misses in a swing and a miss tournament. Flogging a dead horse, it was so dull. She doesn't understand that the only thing she can't get Starmer on is following the process. Andy says, Keir was on form today, took no prisoners, knew the timeline inside out. For goodness sake, can't she move on? And open goal, writes Gary, she's hit the corner flag.
Look, he was prepared, right? And he has had 2 or 3 days in the House of Commons answering questions on this to prepare himself for this moment. And he clearly was. And he had answers to every single question that she had, right? But equally, he did what he does every week and very artfully dodges answering the questions that he doesn't want to answer. You also saw that. I think he did, and you saw that with Ed Davey, right? So he didn't want to answer the question about Matthew Doyle.
But not with Cammie Badenoch.
No, and you know, the idea of due process, well, why is due process, you know, not followed? I think everybody feels like the process is the problem, right? That's why it was followed. The process was wrong. The Prime Minister said he's changed it. So therefore, it's not that the process wasn't followed, it's the process was rubbish.
It's the strangest political balloon I can remember, the way that it has been inflated and deflated, sometimes several times in the same day, let alone just in each news cycle. I think we could all spare a thought for Tony, who took the day off because Sky News said that PMQs was going to be big box office today.
Tony, what were you thinking?
I mean, it's slightly odd set of priorities at the best of times,
also,
Tony.
What kind of job are you doing, Tony? You could just take a little random day off. That's great. Good for you.
Self-employed.
Probably.
And on it goes. So, I mean, has it gone to bed now?
No, it's absolutely not going to bed. And Cammie Badenoch went on this because she knows that it's not. But equally, she found herself reverting to asking questions about documents that came out 2 months ago and that actually happened 2 years ago, when she's talking about, why did the Prime Minister appoint him in the first place? Why did the Prime Minister ignore the advice from Simon Case not to pre-vet him? These are all questions that, to be fair, I don't think he's really answered. And actually, you've got that from Pat McFadden today, who gave very good answers, I thought, about why the situation we were in, about why Bandelson was appointed in the first place. It's something that most ministers at the moment, just, it's an argument they're not going anywhere near. But at the time, we needed somebody to handle Donald Trump. And the Prime Minister now feels scared of making that argument, I think, in public, because he's so politically exposed by it. The question of error of judgment, the Prime Minister mentioned again Ollie Robbins and why he sacked him. There are still questions about that. And MPs are saying that they do feel that it might be unfair. Pat McFadden again today couldn't say whether he thought it was fair to sack Ollie Robbins. So he's in your camp, James. He thinks that he should potentially not have been sacked at all.
This is what I talk about, balloons being inflated and deflated. Starmer did enough there to tempt me back from the precipice of thinking he needs to go sooner rather than later. He's taken some of the sting out of this story, but by no means all of it. But the two questions I'm left with now almost cancel each other out. I think these are the two biggest questions left on the table. Why did he sack Ollie Robbins? And why didn't Ollie Robbins tell him that Mandelson had failed elements of his vetting?
So I think we have the answer to question two. We heard it from Ollie Robbins time and time again. He thought that he couldn't do so. Yeah, so that's his.
See, I've got Sir Maurice Oldfield in my back pocket this morning.
This is another reference I'm not going to get.
Well, it's up there with the pathetic sharks, although it's a little bit more political than... Sir Maurice Oldfield, and I actually learned this from Tom Watson, the former Deputy Labour leader's Substack. Sir Maurice Oldfield was the head of the security services, head of the Secret Intelligence Service, which is MI6, from 1973 to 1978. He's widely regarded as being one of the inspirations for George Smiley from the John le Carré novels. And when Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister in 1979, she appointed him security coordinator in Northern Ireland. At which point, after his appointment, his vetting clearance was reviewed, because he would already have been vetted as head of MI6. And he lost his job. The vetting threw up new developments.
Concerns, yeah.
That Margaret Thatcher was told about.
Okay. So that's a really good historic precedent there.
It's a heartbreaking story, because he was gay. And he hadn't revealed that when he was first interviewed to join the security services. But by 1979, when he was re-vetted, the subject came up.
Mm.
And he answered it honestly. But because he had been dishonest in his original application, it did for him.
That's really interesting.
It's an incredibly poignant tale. And he died shortly afterwards. Margaret Thatcher actually visited him in hospital.
I've definitely heard about this guy before.
His brother asked him why he seemed so distressed after she left, and he said, "Mrs. Thatcher asked me if I was homosexual. I had to tell her. As the light was fading on their eldest brother's life, this was the only time his family had ever heard any suggestion of that kind in relation to him, and it had come from the Prime Minister." And according to all of Oldfield's family, Margaret Thatcher conducted herself throughout this episode with extraordinary kindness and sensitivity.
Hmm.
But the point is that somebody told her he had failed his vetting.
Mm. And look, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Maybe laws have changed. Maybe civil service codes have been updated. But, you know, that argument is exactly what Number 10 are pointing to that sort of argument. They're saying that...
And that's why he was sacked.
Yeah, and they're saying that he should have been told. And look, you know, reticent to put myself in Ollie Robinson's position, but I might have felt the same way. So it's tough. But also, you know, why did the Prime Minister sack him?
Because he didn't tell him about the vetting.
Sure, exactly. So we do have a little bit of answer.
Cross that question off the list.
Yeah, I think so.
And we're left with why didn't he tell him? To which his answer is, I didn't think I was allowed to.
Yeah, but it's like I say, it's all a matter of
and my balloon's deflated again.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry about that. staying with Viz magazine, Ty's been in touch. He says, a random pointless fact for you, James. David Bowie was an avid reader of Viz magazine for all of his life. I knew that, actually. I'm a big Bowie fan, but I got a random pointless fact for you, Ty, which is that David Bowie's son, Duncan, is such a fan of comic art that he actually wrote a graphic novel. It's the sequel to his film Moon. It's called Madi, M-A-D-I, Once Upon a Time in the Future, and it's a thing of absolute beauty. And I know that because Duncan sent me a copy of it for my 40th birthday, would you believe?
Guy.
Or was it my 50th? No, it was my 50th birthday. It was only about 4 years ago. When was it published?
I think I'm getting confused. Viz magazine, there was a magazine when I was growing up called Miz, teen girl magazine. This is not the same, right?
No, definitely my 50th birthday. Definitely Viz, not Miz. Definitely time for the headlines with Matt Hewitt.
Sir Keir Starmer's insisted at Prime Minister's Questions that no pressure whatsoever was put on the Foreign Office to fast-track the vetting of Lord Mandelson as ambassador to the US. He told the Commons that yesterday's evidence from the ministry's sacked chief puts to bed all the allegations levelled at me about the affair. A jump in diesel and petrol prices due to the Middle East conflict has lifted inflation in the UK to its highest level since December. It hit 3.3% in March, with rises in airfares and food prices also responsible. And the UK's welcoming the extension of a ceasefire between the US and Iran, but at least three ships have been hit by gunfire in the Strait of Hormuz. LBC weather, mainly dry and sunny, highs of 11 to 18 Celsius.
This is LBC. At Pets in a Pickle, we're here when it matters most. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Calling all young creatives. Kickstart your career in media. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12 at Global Academy. globalacademy.com.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted.
But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900. Ugh, drizzly drive to the office. Ever wanted to just shove some bits in a bag? Hop on a plane and land somewhere magnifique? Well, with Kayak Explore, it's easier than ever. Whatever your budget, wherever you want to go, simply set the amount you want to spend and Kayak finds flights that fit. Easy breezy. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
33 minutes after 12. Simon Mark standing by. I just thought I'd draw your attention to the Ten Commandments before we talk to Simon. I mean, the real ones, not the Ten Commandments of journalism or anything like that, because Donald Trump has been espousing his Christian beliefs by reading a passage from the Bible, and it's easy to forget what they are, even if you go to church every Sunday. They rarely remind you, I am the Lord your God, you shall not have any other gods before me. I'd say he'd broken that one with the picture of him depicted as Jesus. It's debatable, but I'd say that was 52-48. You shall not, it's no idols next, you shall not make or worship graven images. He's broken that one, hasn't he? Posting pictures of himself as massive statues, wanting big graven images. Do not take God's name in vain. Swears like a trooper. Keep the Sabbath holy. I don't think many Christians do that anymore, but he's broken that one as well. Honour your father and mother. He's probably all right on that. Do not murder, or thou shalt not kill if you prefer. I don't think he's killed anyone personally, but he's boasted about his willingness to do so, of course. And then you've got the rest. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Wah, wah. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness, which means lying or testifying falsely against your neighbour or indeed anyone else. Wah, wah. And finally, thou shalt not covet. It's not just your neighbour's wife, by the way. It's anything that your neighbour has got. But Donald Trump does more coveting than the King of Covetland. So when it comes to the Ten Commandments, not the biggest Christian on the planet, but Simon Marks at great pains today or yesterday to point out just what a real Christian he is. This is because the Jesus stuff and the Pope stuff has hit him in parts that other scandals that actually involved offending or hurting real human beings have not hit him.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, James. I think there will be those people who wonder whether Donald Trump has not indeed breached the thou shalt not kill commandment. Of course, yes. I mean, this is the President of the United States who, during his first term in office, dispatched a record number of federal death row prisoners to the execution chamber. And of course, as the commander-in-chief of the American military, and now clearly desirous of using the American military to advance what he thinks are America's national security goals, there will be many families of innocent victims in various theatres, including now, of course, Iran, who would argue that he absolutely has breached that particular commandment. The section of the Bible passage that he read out yesterday was not coincidental. It was from the seventh chapter, and I'm no expert on this, believe me. It's from the seventh chapter of 2 Chronicles, which is a book in the Old Testament portion of the Bible, the 14th verse. And it has been articulated by numerous figures on the right here at numerous events over the last several years to sort of underpin the notion that America actually should terminate the constitutional historical separation of church and state that exists here. It is a passage that has been used to promote the notion that America was created as a Christian nation and needs to repent of its sins and return to God. So, you know, stung as he absolutely has been by the ludicrous effort last week to depict himself as Jesus healing the sick, and then to claim, oh, I thought I was dressed up as a doctor in that image. possibly because one of his White House aides told him it was a doctored image and he didn't quite understand what he was being told. This is an effort, I think, to redouble and to double down and to reestablish a firmer underpinning of his relationship with Christians who were enraged last week in their thousands, even on his own social media account, by what many of them argued was an act of blasphemy.
We should have a little listen to it, because I think we can fairly say that the next time the audiobook contract comes up for renewal, I don't think he's going to be at the front of the queue. But, I mean, under your account, we're bringing Thou Shalt Not Kill back into the picture. He's arguably on the hook for 8, 9, or 10 of the Ten Commandments being broken in the course of one pitiful life. But anyway, here he is trying to make amends.
And as for you, if you will walk before me as David your father walked and do according to all that I have commanded you and shall observe my statutes and my judgments, then will I establish the throne of my kingdom according to as I have covenanted with David your father, saying there shall not fail you as a man to be ruler in Israel. But if you turn away and forsake my statutes and my commandments, which I have set before you, and shall go and serve other gods and worship them.
Okay. So last week, I mean, no one's mentioned today that he's criticised Keir Starmer for appointing Peter Mandelson to ambassador, which I think only the Daily Mail has picked up on in this country, because, of course, this is a man that appointed Pete Hegseth, Kash Patel, J.D. Vance, and sundry others, and Robert F. Kennedy. This, in the last week, we've learned that his health secretary once stopped to pick up some roadkill, cut the penis off a dead raccoon and took it home to study at a later date. His war secretary thought he was quoting from the Bible when he was actually quoting from the Quentin Tarantino film Pulp Fiction. The head of the FBI is now taking legal action against a magazine article that I think cited 20 or 30 sources describing his alleged drunkenness in the office. I've read that they're no longer making influenza vaccines compulsory for members of the military. Off the top of my head, Simon Marks, I apologise. I can't remember how many US troops died as a consequence of the massive influenza outbreak of the First World War, or in that rough era. I think it was 35,000. I mean, we gave up almost on there coming a moment when it would all become unsustainable. And yet, lo and behold, it feels as if that moment has arrived, culminating this week in reports that his own aides, his closest aides, aren't really telling him anything about what is going on outside of his own brain.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it is tempting, obviously, to find humour in a lot of the things that have happened over the course of the last week, and indeed some of them are, on their merits, very funny.
A raccoon's penis is always going to be funny, Simon. It doesn't matter what the context is.
It can't not be funny,
no,
right?
No, exactly.
But, you know, this is deeply, deeply worrying. Yeah. This is an administration that evidently now has lost the plot, lost its way, lost its direction, cannot articulate still why the United States, in a fact-based way, decided to engage with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in going to war against Iran, putting American lives at risk. Already more than a dozen American service personnel have lost their lives in that particular theater. And this is a president whose own actions on a daily basis demonstrates deep-rooted instability that we now know senior figures within his inner circle are struggling to kind of protect the government from. So every single day, there is an absolute storm of activity on his Truth Social account, often going on until 2:30 in the morning. Mm. An array of absolutely, completely contradictory messages, particularly over Iran. We see the president still unable to understand why Iran has not bent to his will and demonstrating that he doesn't even understand really the nature of the Iranian regime. I mean, if we take a look at what happened yesterday beyond Truth Social, he gave an interview around this time yesterday to CNBC, spent 37 minutes on the telephone. How he had the time to do that, who knows? And this time yesterday morning, at that particular moment, he was itching to unleash the US military on Iran's electrical power plants and their bridges. Take a listen to what he said to CNBC about that issue 24 hours ago.
Well, I expect to be bombing because I think that's a better attitude to go in with, but we're ready to go. I mean, the military is raring to go.
Whoa.
So absolute bravado there from President Trump 24 hours ago at a point where it appeared that Vice President J.D. Vance was about to be dispatched on Air Force Two, flying 17 hours to Islamabad for more face-to-face talks with the Iranians. There were doubts about whether those talks would take place, but the plan was still for J.D. Vance to go. And then later in the day, around lunchtime here, they conceded it wasn't going to happen because the Iranians had essentially said to Trump, if you're going to keep blocking the Strait of Hormuz, and remember, it's the American Navy now blockading the Strait of Hormuz and putting the world economy at risk. If you're going to carry on doing that, we're not ready to have any conversations until you reopen the Strait. So it became apparent the Iranians weren't going to go to Islamabad. So J.D. Vance, Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner, you know, this relatively motley crew that he sent into the first round of negotiations with, by the way, four PhDs from Iran, they decided they weren't traveling either. But listen also to what the president had to say yesterday in that interview with CNBC that is such an insight into his approach to this Iran conflict when it began on February the 28th, and which inadvertently, I think, helps explain why the United States and all the rest of us find ourselves in such a jam.
I just looked at a little chart. World War One, 4 years and 3 months. World War Two, 6 years. Korean War, 3 years. Vietnam, 19 years. Iraq, 8 years. I would have won Vietnam very quickly. I would have, if I were president, I would have won Iraq in the same amount of time that we won, because essentially we've won here.
Essentially, we've won here. He said again that regime change has already occurred when it blatantly, obviously has not. Yeah. And then this notion that if he'd been president during Vietnam or Iraq, you know, he would have solved both of those problems in a matter of weeks, not many, many years, when he has walked into a trap that the Iranians continue to set him on a daily basis. He's found himself leading the US military into another quagmire, having promised the American voters that is exactly what he was not going to do. And now the Iranians are simply not giving him the opening that he desperately needs to exit this conflict at a time, James, when it is costing him monumental amounts of support here in the United States among his own supporters and followers.
What's the pivot there? I know there's some new polling from AP Nork. The key question really has been for a while, when will the Republicans open their eyes?
Yeah, and the key question is being answered partly in that AP poll. First of all, it shows, it was published last night, the president's overall approval rating cratering to 33%. That's the lowest point it has yet been at. But when you dig into the poll and you see what Americans are saying about Trump's handling of the economy, only 30% of Americans approve of his handling of the economy. That is 9 points that the president has lost since the war on Iran began. And we also saw polling late last week that suggested among Republican voters, just 52% of Republicans now say they strongly approve of his presidency. And again, that was down 6 or 7 percentage points since the war began. And then we've also seen, you know, the ludicrous, laughable pivot by Tucker Carlson, former Fox News star, now a very successful podcaster, who has now recognized that, you know, tying yourself to Trump's wagon is no longer viable. And so this week has apologized apologise to the American people ever for having promoted Trump in the first place, accepting that he has incriminated himself by doing that. But he's clearly now completely ditching Trump because he recognises that his own future relies on no longer being tied to an increasingly unpopular American president who is leading his own party to all but certain defeat in the midterm elections in November.
I'm afraid I missed that somehow. What, a full...
Yeah.
What's the word? What's the biblical
full apology.
Word?
Full really? Apology. He had a conversation...
Repudiation.
With, a full repudiation. He had a conversation... He was recording a conversation with Joe Kent, the former national security official who quit the government over the war in Iran. And it was during the course of this extended conversation that... Carlson formally dropped the boom on Trump and separated himself from him.
Well, at least Dick Littlejohn is still loyal. So, you know, Donald Trump's got that at least, I suppose.
The notion that Tucker Carlson is now suffering from Trump derangement syndrome, I'm sure we're going to be seeing those accusations on our respective social media feeds, is a moment that I think neither of us expected to find ourselves relishing.
Any minute now. And just to prove the point that we often make about there being too much to keep up with, we haven't touched upon the newly appointed head of newly appointed holder of a senior role at FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, a far-right conspiracy theorist who, and I read these things, Simon, and I think it must be April the 1st, and I check and I double-source them, and this has been around for a month. Greg Phillips claims that he was teleported to a Waffle House.
To
a Waffle House.
Yes. What more can one say? I mean, this, of course, the Federal Emergency Management Agency that Donald Trump and people on the right of the Republican Party have argued should be shut down, should be scrapped, because the last thing you need in a country that is beset by hurricanes and all sorts of other uncertainties, including possible national security emergencies, is a Federal Emergency Management Agency. That all of this should somehow be relying on...
Well, it's poor people that need help, isn't it? It's poor people that need help in crises and emergencies. So rich people can just hop on a yacht or jump on a plane, or where did that fella go during the... Was there a hurricane in his own state and he went on holiday to Mexico? Was that Rubio or one of the other ones?
Ted Cruz is never in Texas when there's a hurricane.
No, well, that's why you don't need FEMA. That's why you don't need FEMA. You've got...
Exactly.
Oh, man alive. Simon, always a pleasure. We'll do it again, I think, before the week is out. But once again, we're doing a little bit more than scratching the surface, but a sense of jeopardy now moving up a level. If people like... I mean, that is a big rat to flee the sinking ship in the case of Tucker Carlson. But as I say, Dick Littlejohn over the Daily Mail, he's still there with his little polyester Donald Trump flag, insisting that he's the best thing since sliced bread. And extraordinarily, Viscount Rothermere is still paying him for it. So make of that what you will. The time now is 10 to 1.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Two calls at PMQs for Keir Starmer to resign and no noisy support from his backbenchers. How long has he got? Liz Truss says the Iran war is a necessary one and should we end strip searching children?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
You want weight loss advice?
Weight loss? Actually, what you want to do...
I got my weight loss secret from my mother, who got it from her mother's...
My tip is...
Weight loss?
Just
keep dancing.
Dragon fruit.
Podcast.
Advice.
Or you could go to MedExpress. MedExpress. Healthcare without the noise. Go to medexpress.co.uk/weightloss.
Ali 60 milligram hard capsules contain orlistat for overweight adults with a BMI of 28 plus. Follow a reduced calorie, low fat diet. Always read the label.
Chase is the digital bank that gives you 1% cash back on groceries.
So can I get cash back on cake mix?
Indeed.
And icing?
Yep.
And sprinkles?
Sure.
And candles?
Yeah. And you can turn all that cash back into a nice birthday treat.
How do you know it's my birthday?
Just a hunch. Get 1% cash back on groceries, fuel and everyday transport when you spend with Chase. Search Chase Bank. 18 plus UK residents. 1% cash back on this debit card spending for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Eligibility and exceptions apply. May be changed or withdrawn.
At Pets in a Pickle, we're here when it matters most. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are.
Visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
At Lidl, we're giving you 50% off a fruit or veg item on your next shop. Just scan the Lidl Plus app at checkout, and when you scan, you'll be in with a chance to win your whole shop back. Open Lidl Plus and start saving today. Lidl, more to value. 18 plus GB residents, various prices available, subject to availability, end 30/5/26. Full T's and C's apply. See lidl.co.uk/lp-terms.
Time to bring your out-of-date kitchen up to date. Wickes has over 80 kitchen styles, so you can find the perfect one. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wickes.
Calling all young creatives. Kickstart your career in media. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12 at Global Academy. Globalacademy.com.
The following is from TFL.
My name was Luna, like the moon. I was 2 days short of my 17th birthday when I was killed. My killer wasn't a bad man. He'd had a rescue dog called Frank and rang his mum every Sunday. He wasn't a speed freak. He just thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit. But that was enough to knock me off my bike and kill me.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall. Energising a better Britain.
12:52, and I've said to you on a few occasions that the one saving grace of the UK media at the moment is the trade press. Inside Housing, of course, covered itself in glory, for want of a better word, given the horrific nature of the story that I'm about to refer to, in the aftermath of the Grenfell Tower fire. But they really do extraordinary journalism, and it is to one of their journalists, Catherine Swindles, that we turn next, because, Catherine, you have been looking at the scale of, anti-immigrant views and misinformation on social media. That is very much dog bites man territory. But the impact that they're having specifically on staff and tenants in the world of social housing is something that hasn't really had the spotlight shone on it before. Why did you decide to shine this spotlight, and what did you find?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for saying such nice stuff about Inside Housing. We've been hearing a lot across the sector, so housing associations and council housing departments, about particularly around this narrative that, you know, all social housing is going to migrants. And so we wanted to dig into it further and find out, you know, how that's spreading and what the impact is on residents and on staff. And most significantly, we found that we surveyed hundreds of staff across the sector and found 2/3 of staff said they'd come across this kind of misinformation, and 72% had come across it online. And it's frankly not true. So it's, you know, really important that the sector addresses this.
The story that you open the article with, you points to how in the world of social media, not being true doesn't matter. You find a customer service officer at a Liverpool housing association who is kind of ambushed, which is the tactic of these characters, by, you know, people wielding phones and filming them, asking about whether it's true that homes in a new development are going to be given to migrants over local people on the waiting list. She explains that that's not true at all. And the next thing you know, she's on a YouTube film entitled The Great Replacement is Here, having her video or her face attached to the ludicrous claim that 95% of the homes in the new development are going to go to migrants. I mean, that is what reality or the truth is up against. But the personal toll on individuals like this one must be quite considerable. It's a horrible thing to happen.
Absolutely. Like, can you imagine, kind of, you're in your workplace and you're, you know, you have to respond in the moment and try and stay level-headed, and then you see yourself, I mean, I've watched the video, and some really, really awful kind of Islamophobic and racist claims in there. So really upsetting just to have your face attributed to that. And the Chartered Institute of Housing calls this myth a zombie myth. It just refuses to die, that that all housing is going to migrants, when in reality the figures show only 1 in 10 new social tenancies goes to a non-UK national, and only 7% of social housing tenants across England and Wales have a non-UK passport.
Let's say that again, actually, just to drive the point home. This is not an opinion, this is counting. This is the government's figures, as cited by the policy advisor at the Chartered Institute of Housing, who states that 1 in 10 new social tenancies in England goes to a non-UK national, and that the last census found that only 7% in total of all tenants across England and Wales had a non-UK passport for people outside London, because London is such a melting pot and a metropolis. No one has put it better than Mrs. Brown in the Paddington Bear books. When you take London out of the picture, those percentages and those proportions will fall exponentially. So it is a relatively tiny proportion of all tenants and all recipients of new homes, and yet it continues to be the hottest of political footballs. Should politicians be doing more to burst this balloon of bile?
Yeah, I think they need to make it absolutely clear, especially, you know, asylum seekers are singled out for this kind of attention, but asylum seekers are not eligible for social housing. They receive a very, very small amount of basic support. And if, you know, after months or even years, they get refugee status, then they do become eligible, but they're on the list the same as everybody else, which is a very, very long list, 1.3 million people across the country.
And how does it manifest against people who are inhabiting their homes entirely legally and fairly, and without passport inspections going on? What else can these characters rely on but skin colour to pontificate or reach conclusions about the origins of their of people living in social housing?
Exactly. We heard some really upsetting stuff in the survey, things like... I talked to a staff member who said she was showing a Muslim family around a property and they had residents bang on the door and say, you know, that family's not welcome here, things like that. Obviously, that family then, you know, didn't feel safe moving in there, even though they waited their turn on the waiting list, same as everybody else. We heard about, you know, huge England flags painted on people's houses and death threats posted through people's doors. Really, really scary hate crimes.
And, you know, some of the first stuff that I encountered in this job, here's one from Ellis: every single property that comes available on my girlfriend's estate, and then he uses capital letters, goes to a migrant, which is A, something that would be impossible for Ellis to establish, not least because he has an IQ in single figures, and B, and quite dangerous. My first phone call on this subject about 20 years ago came from someone telling me live on the radio that if you were an immigrant in their borough, you got a free shop. Catherine, you got given a shop. Literally, I said there's a parade of shops. So I think they even mentioned where it was, and you weren't allowed to have them if you were British. But if you were an immigrant and you wanted a shop, you could just go down the council and they'll give you a shop. Can people be disabused of these prejudices? I mean, work like yours is powerful and important, but inside housing is unlikely to be dropping through Ellis's letterbox anytime soon.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we focus on the staff and, you know, how stressful and difficult this is for them, and specifically for staff who are Black, Asian, or of minority ethnicities. Obviously, that are particularly scary for them. I think we found 40% of them felt they'd been discriminated against by residents in the past year.
Wow.
But we've seen examples of housing associations doing really clear FAQs for their residents, really laying out the reality of exactly how these things work. How the system is, and the fact that there just isn't enough houses to go around, and that means it can feel really, really frustrating, really upsetting to wait a long time. But that is not the fault of migrants, and you know, kind of reassuring people that there's a fair system, and what we need is more homes.
What we need is more homes, and of course, impacting on tenants, and as you remind us, on staff and ethnic minority staff coming under attack from the people that they are in the business of helping on a professional basis. Catherine, it's a fantastic bit of journalism. Thank you for doing it, and thank you for finding some time to talk to us today. Catherine Swindles from Inside Housing Magazine, which, as I say, continues to do incredible work in areas that many journalists on national newspapers with a rather higher profile and much higher budgets should, frankly, feel a degree of shame that they're not either emulating or following up. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the LBC app, where you can also stay up to date with all the latest news, videos and opinions. You can listen to a range of podcasts, including James O'Brien Daily, the best bits from my LBC show every day. And you can download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Swarbrick. But now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much, James. I've been mulling this over for some time. And then this morning, when I was listening to Dame Rachel Rachel D'Souza speaking on Nick Ferrari's programme, that I think it's time we ended the practice, banned the practice of strip searching children under the age of 16. I'll tell you why a little later, and we can talk about it after three. On the subject of Iran and the latest there, both from the Strait of Hormuz and the blockade of Iranian ports, I want to know who caused Iran to continue its uranium enrichment. Was it the terrible, terrible Obama deal, as Trump calls it? Or was it Donald Trump abandoning said deal? We'll look into that. But I begin with Prime Minister's questions and the Prime Minister's fate, his future. Should he go? If so, when will he go? What will cause it? What will prompt it?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, the Prime Minister's insisted the evidence of the sacked Foreign Office chief puts to bed allegations against him over Peter Mandelson's appointment. He's quoted Sir Ollie Robbins, who said he felt no pressure to ensure the Labour peer could take up post in Washington. Sir Keir Starmer says he was never informed of failed security checks. Tory leader Kemi Badenoch says he should take responsibility and resign.
The head of the Foreign Office was sacked for the Prime Minister's own failings. His backbenchers know that is not fair. Even his most loyal cabinet members won't defend it.
But LBC's political editor, Natasha Clark, says Sir Keir lives to fight another day.
Look, he was prepared, right? And he has had 2 or 3 days in the House of Commons answering questions on this to prepare himself for this moment, and he clearly was. But equally, he did what he does every week and very artfully dodges answering the questions that he doesn't want to answer.
The Chancellor says her number one priority is to keep costs down following a rise in inflation last month. The increase to 3.3% is being blamed on rising fuel, flight and food costs because of the Iran war. Fruit and veg importer Edward Velasco says it's having a knock-on impact.
We've got lorries coming in from Spain, Morocco, the rest of Europe, and it's had a huge impact, around £1,000 per lorry. We have, you know, 6, 7 to 10 lorries a day, so it could be £30,000-£40,000 a week of costs. You cannot negotiate that.
A number of ships have been attacked in Iranian waters despite Donald Trump's announcement of an extended ceasefire. The UK military says 2 cargo vessels came under fire in the Strait of Hormuz. It's reported Iranian gunboats have also struck a third. Military analyst Professor Michael Clark says that's according to government-controlled sources.
If they are reporting it, then that means that somebody in Tehran wants them to report it. And that increases the likelihood that this is the Iranian government, as it were, kicking back against Donald Trump, extending the ceasefire. In a way, they're saying, well, we don't care.
And England's Children's Commissioner has raised concerns about young people being strip-searched by police. The number of the searches has halved in 4 years, but Dame Rachel D'Souza says too many are still unnecessary, unsafe and underreported. In the City, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 2 points at 10.496. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, mainly dry and sunny, gusty winds with the odd shower in the southwest of the UK, cloudier skies for the northeast, and highs of 11 to 18 Celsius. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Matt Hewitt.
British Gas have this thing. We call it home care. We'll fix all sorts, and it's unlimited repairs. Expert engineers will solve the upset of boilers not boiling or taps that won't wet. Electrics playing tricks or a pipe that's broke. We're there for everyone. Even blue furry folk. Your home won't feel booby-trapped. It'll feel just like new. British Gas, taking care of things and looking after you. T's and C's apply. Excess options available per repair.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. Let's talk, shall we, this hour about where we find ourselves after Prime Minister's questions, after Ollie Robbins' evidence to the Foreign Affairs Select Committee yesterday, and after the Prime Minister's statement the day before to the House of Commons, pulling all of that together, plus what's happened really since he became Prime Minister, and that sense of disappointment that soon embedded in to this government, and particularly his leadership, perhaps, and where all of that, I know that's a lot to think about, but where all of that brings us to at this point. Natasha Clark joins me, LBC's political editor, and Aggie Chambre, LBC's deputy political editor. We've got a double whammy. We've got the twins in today. Let's start with you, Natasha. You felt, we heard it in the news there, that the Prime Minister survived this Ollie Robbins saga, farrago, particularly today in PMQs. You thought he survived that?
He did. I don't think Kemi Badenoch had any killer knockout blows today, but equally I feel that and many MPs feel that it's only a matter of time now for Starmer, and there's lots of discussion about when that's going to be and about how quickly he's going to go, or whether he just limps on until the next election, until 2029. And we heard from Pat McFadden today, didn't we, the Work and Pension Secretary, who says yes, he's going to fight the next election, but there are so many MPs think there are just going to be too many landmines, too many potential speed bumps that are going to unseat the Prime Minister at some point between now and the next election. And obviously, the first of those is probably the pressure on him this week from the Mandelson scandal ongoing, right? It's been a really difficult week for the Prime Minister, hearing from Ollie Robbins, hearing that testimony, and already we have started to see the Cabinet start to shift. They are starting to distance themselves from Keir Starmer and his government. And
give
maybe
me an example of that.
So Ed Miliband yesterday, speaking on the broadcast round, was asked repeatedly, would you have hired Peter Mandelson? And he said, no, when I was Labour leader back in 2010, I considered potentially a job for Peter Mandelson, and I was told, no, stay well away. And I decided that that was the best for that. Mm. We also heard from Yvette Cooper yesterday, the Foreign Secretary, and she was asked about reports that Ollie Robbins had talked about yesterday of the fact that Number 10 had potentially tried to find a job for Matthew Doyle. She said those reports were very concerning, if indeed true. So distancing herself again from Number 10, and sort of, you've got Cabinet Ministers trying to put their own sort of version of events on, trying to distance themselves from the centre. And that is usually a potential first sign that everything is not all right and not a nest of singing birds, as it were, at the heart of government.
And we'll get onto the exact points at which trouble could still re-emerge. But on that point that you made about cabinet ministers distancing themselves, Aggie, it was notable that the MPs behind in the backbenches, of which there are many, they were relatively quiet in the face of two calls for him to resign from opposition benches.
I think that says everything, really, Sheila. And I think it was always going to be an extremely important Prime Minister's questions for Keir Starmer, not necessarily because of the questions thrown at him by Kemi Badenoch, but because of those crucial people in this story, those people sat behind him. And on days like this, you need to just watch their faces and see how they're reacting. And as you say, them being pretty quiet today, I think says a huge amount. I mean, as Natasha has said, and I completely agree with her, I don't think we're there quite yet. But I don't think that is because MPs aren't extremely unhappy, not extremely angry. It is because of the elections, yep. So the elections, those crucial set of elections in May, in Scotland, Wales, and local elections too in England. And, I mean, MPs are already so angry that this has come up during the campaign.
They're out there canvassing and walking miles and all the rest of it,
and having to talk to voters and try and convince them, and trying to defend positions that the Labour government has made. But it's also, up until the latter part of last week, there was